Welcome to the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families with Dr. Stephen R. Covey. Of all the questions which Stephen has been asked over the years, few are more important than those relating to the deep personal pain which many people feel in their relationships at home. With all the demands on my time, how can I get a sense of balance so that I can succeed at work and at home? Raising children all by myself has worn me out. What can I do to catch my breath and build a better relationship with my children? How can I rekindle the fire in a relationship at home that seems to be cold and out of fuel? How can I discipline my teenage children so that they'll want to do the right things rather than being forced to do them? In this program, Stephen will teach not only how to adequately cope with day-to-day challenges like those, but also how we can overcome and even rise above our present circumstances. Implementing the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families can help to create a happier and more rewarding home and family life with rich and meaningful relationships. Stephen begins now by outlining the purposes of this audio program and shares his deep feelings regarding the importance of home and family relationships.
I would like to begin with 3 purposes. First, I want to communicate the supreme importance of the family. I want to underscore that in every way possible. The second purpose, to show what the role of leadership is in creating a beautiful family culture. You see, the whole concept of a beautiful family culture is the definition of effectiveness. 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families. That means, how do we create a beautiful family culture in a turbulent world? That's the leadership concept. The third purpose, the answer to the how, is to use a new way of thinking. It's a frame of reference. It's called the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families. I want to show how useful this way of thinking is. How you can take any problem, any challenge, any dilemma, and if you will develop this sense of 7 habits and how they are related to each other, you can diagnose that problem and you can lay out an action plan to solve it. I want to create now a few pictures or images in your mind regarding these 3 interwoven purposes. The first image is the image of a wall and a ladder. So you go up one rung after another, and you keep climbing it, and you climb it higher and higher until you get to the top rung, and then you look around, and you have the feeling, this is leaning against the wrong wall. We begin our life in a family. We end our life in a family. From the beginning to the end, it's family. The wall of building a beautiful family culture is the place to put our ladder against. And everything else we do in our life will flow from that. No other single activity is as important. No higher leadership role than parenthood. No greater contribution to society than a strong, healthy, beautiful family. Families are continuing relationships, and even though there have been difficulties and breakups, there is always the power to heal. We will be discussing how that can take place. That's the first image. The image of a wall and of a ladder. And making sure that our ladder leans against the right wall. Against the wall that matters the very most. That has the greatest impact. That has the greatest and deepest satisfaction and sense of fulfillment. One of my little daughters told an experience of a private date that I had with her one time when I took her on a business trip. These are her very words. Businessmen don't usually take the 12-year-old girls on business trips to San Francisco. That's why it made it so exciting when my dad said he was going to take me. We planned it for 6 months. We had 2 days and one night. We planned every detail. Dad would be busy in meetings the first day. I would hang around the hotel. After his meeting, we would take a cab to Chinatown for our favorite Chinese food, then a movie, then a ride on the trolley car at night, then back to our hotel room for a video and hot fudge sundaes from room service. I was dying with anticipation. The day finally arrived. As I waited at the hotel, the hours dragged by. 6 o'clock came and no Dad. At 6:30, he arrived with another man, a dear friend and important client that could influence a lot of business in the future. My heart sank. "I'm so excited you're here, Stephen. Lois and I want to take you to the wharf for a spectacular seafood dinner, and you must see the view from our house." "I'm sorry, Bill, but I have my daughter." "Oh, she can come too, of course. We love having her." "Right," I thought. "I hate fish, and I'll be stuck alone in the back seat while they talk." My disappointment was bigger than life. He was pressing my dad so hard, but I was 12 and I only cried inside. "Gosh, Bill, I'd love to see you both, but this is a special time with my girl. We've already got it planned to the minute. Sorry you came all this way for nothing." We did absolutely everything. There was nothing we missed. How important is the heart of a 12-year-old daughter? It's the heart that belonged to her dad the rest of her life.
In the next illustration, Stephen points out that regardless of present circumstances, it is never too late to start providing strong leadership to our families.
One time, I was visiting with a very prominent business leader. In fact, he was the number two person in a major international firm. And we were visiting after one of my presentations at an airport. And he said to me, "Your presentation, Stephen, really stirred up some deep thoughts. And frankly, I don't know really if I'm happy with what I've done in my life. I don't know if it's been worth it, the price I have paid to get where I am. I could even move on to the number one job. I'm in line for the presidency. But I don't know if I would want to do it. You see, I don't have this feeling in our family that we're talking about here. And I feel like that's where the riches are. It's not in money. It's not in positions. It's in this family relationship." And he said, "I'm feeling kind of heartsick. And I'm in my later 50s, and I could easily be the president for several years. And that would consume me. I know what that takes. I've been on that ladder. I don't know if it's worth it. The feeling just isn't there in our family." But then I saw him do something. "But let me show you something, Stephen." He pulled out of his briefcase the blueprint of a home that he was building. He called it his three-generation home. They were doing it in Savannah, Georgia, right on the beach. It was a beach home for three generations. And he said, "You know, Stephen, this is what excites me." And he started talking about his excitement. He said, "The thing that excites me is how it's exciting my kids and what's happening to them. Because you see, they feel like they lost their childhood with me as well. They miss that feeling as well. And they want it. They need it. And we have a common project together to work on. And so we're working on this project and creating this place. And we're thinking about their children. See, and I want to get close to their children. They're my grandchildren. And in a sense, I am reaching my children through their children. And they love it. They want our involvement with their children. And it's involving us with them. We have a common task together." In a sense, what's happening is that almost indirectly, almost serendipitously, a happy accident is taking place that is providing the leadership in their home that has not been there. They've had home management, but no leadership. And now it's beginning to take place. And he's recapturing their youth through their children. Now, it didn't have to be a home building. It could be any kind of a project. So that in a sense, your hearts turned to your children and the children turned to you. Now, why is this so significant? Because many people have become discouraged. They really have. They have become buffeted so powerfully by the weather that surrounds them or by the internal difficulties inside their family that they have lost the hope of arriving at their destination.
Stephen next uses the analogy of an airplane to explain how families, like airplanes, must constantly self-correct and get back on course in order to eventually arrive at their destination.
Think of the last trip that you have taken on a plane. The image is, the plane takes off at the appointed hour toward a destination that it arrives at the appointed hour. But in fact, the plane is off track 90% of the time, or at least a high percentage of the time. What does that mean, off track? Well, there's a perfect flight plan that is developed at the beginning. The destination is known, and the flight plan is followed. But inevitably, there are different changes that take place, things that could not be anticipated, weather conditions, other traffic, other factors that slightly move that plane off track. However, feedback is given, environmental scanning, information is fed to the pilots, and they adapt, they adjust, and they keep coming back to that flight plan. They keep coming to what is right to get to the destination. If you can create this image in your mind, as long as you have the picture of where you're going to end up, the destination, the place you're going to, what you want to become like, and even though you're off track much of the time, even most of the time, if you will stay with it, if you will not lose your sense of hope and your vision, you will arrive there. You will arrive at your destination. Speaking for myself, I figure my family's off track much of the time too. I figure that I myself am off track much of the time. And that could discourage me by saying, here you are, Stephen, you teach this material, you write about all of this, and now look, you've just displayed a bad attitude in this situation. You did this, and you were unkind here. You overreacted here. You underreacted here, and so forth. But so what? You just keep coming back. That's the point. You never lose sight of your destination. Your conscience has been educated and trained. You know exactly what you need to do, and you just keep coming back. You get back on track. And then you get off, you pull it right back. You get off, you pull it back. And when you arrived there, you realized, I was off most of the time. But I'm here. I'm safe. I'm home. I'm trying to communicate at the beginning of this process, there is enormous hope and encouragement and excitement and fun and enjoyment and happiness and fulfillment in this whole concept of building a beautiful family culture. It can be done. It will be done by you. But it will take time, it will take patience and commitment, but you will arrive at your destination. And don't let anything or anybody say otherwise. Do not be seduced by those that say, it's useless, it's hopeless, nothing can be done, it's too late. Because the very nature of the challenges and the problems that you're having is the essence of your own growth. And you will arrive. I can assure you, you will arrive at this very worthy destination. This beautiful family culture will be yours sooner or later.
Stephen now illustrates the importance of reaching out and helping family members feel secure and needed. He also discusses the need for parents never to give up on their children.
One little girl would run away always to the front porch. Her mother would go out, hug her, and invite her back. One day she did this, and her mother, because she was busy, forgot to get her. After a while, the little girl came back into the house. Her mother hugged her and told her she was glad she was back. The little girl then said, Mama, always come after me. In other words, She wanted that mother to come to her so that she could draw upon that love. And the mother was preoccupied at the time. Mama, always come after me. These are words for parents to live by. Always come after me. I often think about that when children perhaps have gone through a very difficult time, maybe got into destructive lifestyles, and there's been deep estrangement for a period of time. But I'm convinced that deep within their natures is a hunger for home and for Mama, always come after me. Daddy, always come after me. And that it's very important that parents never give up, but keep trying in every way they possibly can to make contact, to show interest, to empathize, to share, to remember birthdays, to renew holidays or special occasions, never to bag them, never to just forget them, thinking they have no interest, but constantly to tend to them and to be very, very prayerful to try to reach them. I really believe most people come back. They come back eventually because they're bone of your bone and flesh of your flesh. They have this overlay of a bad value system and a period of time in their life, but down inside they're saying, come after me. Don't give up on me. Even though I reject you and give up on you, don't give up on me. I really believe that. I've seen it happen so many times, so I would encourage parents, don't get discouraged.
Some things never change. They stay the same year after year, century after century. Principles are changeless. They govern our lives and control the consequences of our actions. Stephen now discusses how we can develop a beautiful family culture by aligning our personal and family values with principles or the natural laws of effectiveness.
Now, as we get into the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families material, we have to realize that it is all based upon principles, that is, upon universal, self-evident, natural laws. If we break them, we only break ourselves against them. Now, the creation of a beautiful family culture is based on a number of these principles. Always the key is alignment with principles. The traditional concept is get in control. We're not in control. Principles control. We control our actions, but the consequences that flow from those actions are controlled by principles. The body, the mind, marriage, family, all relationships, every natural system is governed by principles, by natural law. Now, intellectually, this may not be hard to understand, but emotionally, this is one tough idea, because literally, the social value system of most people are into figuring out some quick fix, some way of shortcutting this natural process. There is none. It's the law of the farm. It's the law of the harvest. We will always reap as we sow. You'd say, yeah, but what about this person or this family? All I'd say is, how's the marriage? Well, he's into his third. How's the quality of his relationship with his teenagers? Well, it's kind of rocky, but look at the money he makes, or look at the prestige that he has, or whatever. It's all cosmetic surface stuff, my friends. There's a lot of things that can give material success that are apart from this, but to take long-term success, not just material success, but social, psychological growth of people, of family members, and a sense of contribution and meaning, I do not think you can find an exception anywhere of a truly effective or successful person or family that does not have at least a pretty good handle on these principles. You can't fake trust or trustworthiness. You can't fake a beautiful family culture. You can struggle to produce one, as we all do, but in the last analysis, that production is based totally on alignment with principles. We must return to principles. We've got to return to those enduring values upon which all true enduring success takes place. The same exact principles operate regardless. Practices change. The everyday practical application of principles will vary. That's why we believe so much in the Eastern statement, give a man a fish, you feed him for the day. Teach him how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. You see, even though you may teach someone a practice, always try to teach the principle which underlies it, because the situation may change and the practice no longer applies, but the principle will be constant. Take time with your family and loved ones to make explicit what principles are. Principles ultimately govern. As Abraham Lincoln put it, people will pass away, but principles will live, live on forever.
Next, Stephen defines the word paradigm and how changing our paradigm, or the way that we see the world, can result in major improvements in our personal and family lives.
Okay, the next concept I'd like to discuss is the concept of a paradigm. This is a scientific term, but it is enormously significant as we talk about becoming more effective as individuals, as parents, and as families. A paradigm basically means a pattern, a model, a representation, something that stands for something else. It comes from the images we carry in our head of the way things are, of reality, or perhaps of the way things should be. All of us think we see the world as it is. In fact, we see the world as we are. You see, we project onto the outside world a certain representation, a certain model, a certain map on what that reality is out there, or should be. It affects the way people do everything that they do, the way they vote, the way they decide, the person they choose to marry, the place they decide to live in, whatever it may be. A person's frame of mind, that is, their underlying map of the territory of the world, drives all of their behavior. The other day a mother said to me, "I cannot believe my child. All of a sudden she turned 17 and she's like a different person. I have never seen anyone so uncooperative, so ungrateful, so rebellious, so angry, so unwilling to do anything to help us at home, or even to be open to any influence at all." Notice what is happening to the map or the paradigm in this mother's head. And what do you do when you have that? You act upon it. So does she. It's the map you have of this person. Now someone could say to you, "Try harder, try to be more positive." But as long as a person carries that map, that image of this other person in their head, they're going to treat them that way. It's called the self-fulfilling prophecy. You see, people basically live up to the social mirror that surrounds them. That is, the cumulative perceptions that surround them. Now I said to this mother, "Notice how you see your daughter." "Well, it's not how I see her. It's the way she is. Potentially, she is capable of so much more." "Oh yeah, yes, I know that," I said. "Why don't you see her in terms of her potential then? Is not her potential part of the reality of her life? Isn't it really the larger part? It's a view based upon her potential that you really deeply believe in." "Yeah, but," she said to me, "what do I do with all this behavior and the total unwillingness to cooperate to do her part?" Again, notice her fundamental paradigm. Observe the map you have of her. See, this is the kind of leadership work you have to do on yourself. Leadership works on the paradigm. Management works through the paradigm. Over the years, in attempting to teach what a paradigm is, I've used many, many illustrations and stories. But the one that has consistently hit home the best is one that I put in the first chapter of the Seven Habits book, having to do with an experience I had in New York City when on a Sunday morning I got into a subway. It was a fairly quiet morning, particularly in contrast with the noise and the raucousness of the evening before, and there weren't many people in the subway car. I was sitting down, reading, and in came a father with some children, who from the moment they entered that car literally went wild. These little kids running up and down, yelling, pulling down people's papers, interrupting people, and the gentleman sat right next to me and did nothing, said nothing. He just sat as if he were oblivious of what was going on. He took no responsibility for his children at all. I could not believe this. I sat there and I could just feel my own attitude getting critical and resentful, and I was trying to get enough control with him myself so I could give some feedback to the man. Eventually, I got enough presence of mind to just say to him, "Sir, do you think you can better handle your children? They're really disturbing a lot of people." And he kind of listened for a second and then kind of lifted his gaze as if he were comprehending what I was saying and then said, "Oh, yes, I guess I should." We just came from the hospital and their mother died about an hour ago. And I guess they don't quite know how to handle it. And frankly, I don't either. Well, that new information totally shifted my paradigm, how I saw the whole situation. You see, attitude and behavior flows from your paradigm, how you see the reality. Well, I saw the whole situation differently, and my only desire was to try to help, to try to serve him in some way, and it did involve some things. But the thing that impressed me was the 180-degree shift in the way I saw the whole situation and how that impacted my attitude and my behavior. It just teaches you forcibly that how you see something affects how you feel and what you do. I've often talked a great deal about the greatest way and the quickest way to change a person's behavior is to change their paradigm, which means how they see themselves, their map that they have of themselves. That is the quickest way to change a person's behavior. Well, change their name or change their role, and you've changed their paradigm. As soon as you became a father, a mother, did you not see the world differently? Entirely differently? When you became a grandparent, did you not see the world differently? See, that's a new paradigm. When you became a leader, did you not see the world differently? See, your role has changed. You see the world differently. The quickest way to change a person's behavior is to change their paradigm. Don't work on their behavior. Don't work on their attitude. Just change how they see their role, how they see their responsibility, their stewardship.
Stephen continues his discussion of effectiveness and family leadership by describing how we can improve the quality of our family relationships and create a happier home environment by making constant deposits into the emotional bank accounts of family members.
Now let's consider the relationships we have with each other. The metaphor I love to use is the emotional bank account. It's a metaphor that describes the amount of trust and confidence that's been built up in a relationship. It's the feeling of safeness you have with another human being. So that if you make deposits into the emotional bank account, little by little you build a reserve capacity. Then your trust becomes higher and higher. You could even make mistakes, and the trust level, that emotional reserve, will compensate for it. But if, on the other hand, if you have a pattern of making what I call emotional bank account withdrawals, such as discourtesy, disrespect, breaking my commitments, eventually you get into an overdrawn emotional bank account. Or you may sometimes have a pretty good sized emotional bank account, but then you make one huge mistake, one basic withdrawal that violates the deepest sense of your relationship. It could cause the whole emotional bank account to be overdrawn in one fell swoop. The trust gets very low then, and you have almost no flexibility. It's like walking on minefields. You have to be very careful about everything. You constantly are watching your backside. Everything you say, you have to measure every word. It's tension city all around the home, and many families literally are filled with it. Many marriages are filled with it. The interesting thing about relationships is that if you have frequent contacts with the same people, unless you are constantly making deposits, the ones you made before are so fragile, they evaporate very rapidly. You must continually make deposits with people you know well, because the expectation is so high. This is especially true in marriage and in family life. Many of you out there are thinking of a relationship you care about a lot, and it's wounded, it's hurt. You'd like to rebuild it. Think about these deposits. Many of you may be starting a new relationship that is rather tenuous and tender, not wounded, not hurt, but just beginning. Think about these deposits. Others of you may have an actual ruptured relationship where there is no contact at all, yet the person is still precious to you. Think about these deposits. They all basically are principles. Okay, let's look at each of these, because they are so important. What are the key deposits to build this beautiful family culture, this emotional bank account?
Some things I do to make deposits to my children is to spend time with them on their homework, to praise them, to compliment them on their homework, to compliment them on little things that they do. For instance, my five-year-old is still going through growing changes in terms of learning how to do certain things for himself. I give them an opportunity to participate in the family chores, no matter how small it is. For instance, just one of his tasks is to just take care of the silverware. His task will be to dry it and to put it in the separate places with forks, the knives, spoon, and to compliment him when he does well and to compliment him if he doesn't do so well.
What I am learning right now is what real deposits are for my husband. I had this preconceived notion of what I thought they were. I have really gone through a learning process that what I think is a deposit isn't necessarily, and so deposits for him have been to follow through with commitments, follow through with promises. Deposits for my children, because they're young, is time, real quality time, not just I wanted to go ahead and watch a movie, because that's been a real easy escape for all of us. I can get things done. They're entertained, but is that really a deposit?
One of the deposits that I religiously make is sometime during my week at home, because I work a crazy schedule. I work a week up in the Arctic, and then I come home for a week. During my week off, I've always had a weekend date with my wife, always. We always go somewhere, even if it's just, you know, dinner and a movie, or sometimes we'll drive into Anchorage and see a show, but it's always something that we go out and do together. With the kids, it could be anything from sitting down playing a game, taking a walk, birthday parties, going to their athletic events, trying to always make sure that they understand that we're there and supporting.
Do you know what the first deposit we need to make always is? To understand another person, to understand them within their frame of reference. Why? Because you do not know what a deposit or a withdrawal is to another person. You see, the key to every deposit you make is that you do it from within their frame of reference. You may think that treating people kindly in this particular way, because that's the way you like to be treated, is a deposit to them. It could be absolutely opposite to them. It's a very common tendency. It's called projection. We project our feelings, our motives, on other people's behavior. And so, if this would mean something to us, therefore it would mean something to them. Not so. They come out of a totally different world. The essence of the golden rule is to treat others as you would like to be treated, because you like to be treated as a unique, different person. But people adapt to your unique reality. And so that you would be treated perhaps differently than how someone else would like to be treated. Why? Because it came out of your frame of reference. This first deposit always is to know what deposits are, because all the other deposits come from it. The second deposit, make and keep promises. The moment you give a promise to someone, you've created a hope. The moment you've created a hope, people start to anticipate, and they become emotionally open and vulnerable. And that's one reason why many insecure people make promises very easily. They love the psychic feeling of people being happy with them. Oh, that's so exciting. We're going to do this. We're going to go on this trip. We're going to go out to dinner. And Dad promised me that Saturday morning we would go and visit that gym. Dad promised me. See, look at the hope. Look at the anticipation. Look at the vulnerability. Then when it isn't kept, disillusionment sets in. If you have broken a lot of promises, people won't believe the promises to begin with. When it comes to a really important promise to another person, count the cost before you make it. You might even say, I can't give it as a promise. All I can say is, if these situations are favorable, I will give it a good try. The person will be a little disappointed. You're not into a popularity contest. You're not into immediate satisfaction of somebody. You're into building trust. Trust is greater in the initial stages than being liked. It's not to be liked, it's to be trusted, to be respected. Eventually, such a person will not only be liked, they will be loved. They will become beloved. But in the initial stages, and often during difficult times, be more true to principles than you are to people. But that tests you. It really does. So learn to make and keep promises. Breaking promises or not making them, that also is withdrawal. If you can make it, what a pleasant, marvelous thing to have this anticipation. So don't get to the point where you don't make promises because you're afraid of not keeping them. Make them, but make them very carefully. Make them sparingly, particularly when you're dealing with promises that are really foundational. And of course, the most foundational promise we ever make is the vow inside a marriage, the ultimate promise. And the promise that we implicitly have with our children, particularly when they're little, is that we will take care of them, that we will nurture them, and that we will care for them, particularly when they are not lovable. Third deposit, just a simple kindness. When we show our kindness by just being courteous, thank you, please, when we're helpful, can I help you? We build this beautiful family culture. We build the emotional bank account. These are small acts. But you know, these small kindnesses and these small courtesies, these small illustrations of gentleness and consideration and respect make huge deposits. Similarly, small discourtesies, small unkindnesses, little forms of disrespect eventually create huge withdrawals. You see, in relationships, the little things are the big things. You know, I remember one time I spent an evening with two of my sons at a father's and son's outing some years ago. It was very well organized. It had gymnastics and wrestling matches and good refreshments, hot dogs, and then finally, a movie. In the middle of the movie, Sean, who was then just 4 years old, fell asleep in his seat. His older brother, Stephen, who was six, stayed awake, and we watched the rest of the movie together. When it was over, I picked Sean up in my arms, carried him out to the car, laid him gently in the back seat. It was very cold that night, so I took off my coat and wrapped it around him. When we arrived home, I quickly carried Sean in and tucked him into bed. He was still asleep. After Stephen had put on his jammies and brushed his teeth, I lay down next to him to talk about the night out together. How'd you like it, Stephen? Fine, he answered. Did you have fun? Yes. What did you like the most? I don't know, the trampoline, I guess. Wasn't that quite a thing, doing those somersaults and tricks in the air like that? There was so little response on his part. I found myself forcing questions, making conversation. I just wondered why Stephen wouldn't open up a little more. He usually did when exciting things happened. I was a little disappointed, frankly. But I sensed something was wrong. He'd been also so quiet all the way home when getting ready for bed. Suddenly, Stephen turned over on his side facing the wall, so I couldn't see his face. I wondered why. I lifted myself up just enough to see his eyes welling up with tears. What's wrong, honey? What is it? He turned back, and I could sense he was feeling some embarrassment for the tears and his quivering lips and chin, and he said, Daddy, if I were cold, would you put your coat around me too? Of all the events of that special night out together, the most important with a little kindness, a momentary unconscious showing of love to his little brother. What a powerful personal lesson that experience was to me then and is even now. You see, people are very, very tender, very sensitive inside. In fact, I don't believe age or experience or position makes much difference. Inside, even with the most toughened and calloused and sophisticated exteriors, are the tender feelings and emotions of the heart. The truest test of a family culture is how you treat the child that tests you the very most. There's no test with a child that is cooperative and pleasant, congenial and obedient and helpful and so forth. And that's no test. The test of love is when you're dealing with someone who is unlovable, who is rebellious or indifferent and ungrateful. After all you have done, after all I have done, Simon, look at the attitude you take. That is the test. If you can maintain consistent love, now that doesn't mean you may not discipline behavior as agreed upon by the consequences of stewardship agreements or by the fundamental values of your family. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about even giving feedback on behavior. What I'm talking about is that withdrawal of a feeling that I matter, that I am a precious person, that I count in this other person's mind, see. When that is withdrawn, even to the slightest, you know what's happened? That person feels like, wow, I don't know if there's any worth in me. And the other children, noticing that, say essentially the same thing. See, the key to the many is how you treat the one. The key to the 99 is not that you neglect them going after the one, but you preserve the 99 by going after the one. Why? Because everyone is a one. Everyone knows they too would receive the same treatment. And if these children go up feeling like no matter what happened, there's this love, this unconditional love. There may be discipline. There may be consequences. There may be description of bad behavior that is not healthy and so forth. But there's never a withdrawal or a diminution of love. These are small acts. But you know, these small kindnesses and these small courtesies, these small illustrations of gentleness and consideration and respect make huge deposits. Another extremely important deposit, receiving feedback. The withdrawal would be, don't get feedback, don't receive it. And when you give it in the form of an I message. In a family setting, you want to have a beautiful family culture. So that's why it's important to get feedback from children. And for children to get it from parents. And then when you give feedback, always describe yourself, not them. You say, as I see it, my perception is, my feeling, my opinion. You're describing you, not them. And you describe it in the form of an I message. My concern is. One time, my wife and I were discussing a selfish pattern we saw in one of our sons. And it was going on for such a long period of time that it was offending people and us, and we could have easily given quick feedback. Just fed it in there real fast, see? And sometimes we've done that, but I said to myself, I've got to pay the price on this. This is a deeply embedded tendency, and this is not his nature. This is not like him. He has so much graciousness and selflessness and goodness, but he needs to know I feel that. We were on a family vacation on a lake, and we had this little Honda 90 trail cycle, and I asked him if he wanted to go for a ride around the lake. And we went for this long, long ride, and we stopped and had drinks out of freshwater streams and so forth. We were gone, I think, probably two and a half, maybe even 3 hours. I don't know, a long time. But I'm telling you, the richness of our relationship, the depth, the laughter, the fun was real. And then at the end, I said, son, one of the reasons I wanted to visit with you, and the reason why I wanted to take this time to get this great feeling between us, is because your mother and I have a concern we would like to share. Now notice, we were describing ourselves, not him. And that's what feedback is. It is a description of yourself. Now you're describing your perception of him. But the moment you start saying, you are so selfish, you are so, look, you're playing God. You're the ultimate judge of that person. And it's if that's the way they are. That's the thing that people resent. That's the thing that offends them so deeply, is that they are fixed, they're labeled, they're judged, they're categorized. They're a thing. They're no longer a person, see? So I said to him, son, would you mind if I shared a concern with you that your mother and I feel? Not at all, Dad. And I shared it. And I shared also my perception of his true nature. You cannot believe the immediate response. Oh, I can see. I don't know. I've just been into myself so much. And I just not been right. And he acknowledged it to his mother, to others around, and began a process and a program of what you call a second mile that was so rich and so real. Now, that was what you might call inefficient, but highly effective. If we'd been efficient, it would have been highly ineffective. Now, think of the amount of time one would take compared to the other. Let's say it took a total of 3 hours. But look, we'd been living 3 months with the other. All I know is, you want to save time, don't be efficient. With people, slow is fast, and fast is slow. Another powerful deposit is patience and persuasion, rather than physical force and coercion. You see, there are so many ways that you can influence people. The traditional influence is called, I'll give you this if you'll give me this. It's kind of a fairness principle. You know, I did this for you, will you clean this? Will you do this? Will you do this? Another very traditional approach is just simply the use of power. The use of position power, the use of money power, the use of physical power, the use of whatever power, so that you come in with something that is strong and you have the power to make it happen. Now, it happens. It's efficient. You can usually get your way. The problem is, in the use of that kind of power, force, coercion, you have, in a sense, violated a relationship, a person, and also built more dependency in you on that power. Patience, softness, kindness, gentleness, showing great love in every possible way, using some persuasion, but when that doesn't work, don't be hard on them. If they do violate or they seem to do something that in their minds was wrong, and you know that in their minds it was wrong, you may have to give a little more direct feedback. And they may feel a little offended at the moment, but then you show forth afterwards more and more kindness and patience and love to them, because they perhaps knew in their heart what had happened. You don't want to become violent or something like that, but you may reprove them pretty sharply sometimes when a situation would require it. But that is very, very occasional, very infrequent. That's why this is an extremely important deposit.
Stephen continues his discussion of the emotional bank account by describing the next deposit, which is to apologize.
The next deposit is probably the one that needs to be exercised the most, but is used the least. It's called apologize. To acknowledge, I was wrong, I apologize, I'm sorry. Please forgive me, I was wrong. And the opposite of that is to be so prideful and arrogant as to not to apologize, but to defend, to justify, to explain, you know, to cover up in some way. And that is a major withdrawal, because inwardly people kind of sense you're doing a song and a dance and you're maybe apologizing half-heartedly. You know, I'll say I'm sorry if you'll say you're sorry. But they can feel the lack of sincerity there. And let's both say it at the same time. Sorry. I said it first. Yeah, but you didn't say it like you meant it. That's not what builds a relationship at all. It is a deep, sincere apology. I was wrong. Son, I embarrass you in front of your friends. That was wrong of me. I'm going to apologize to you and to your friends. I should never have done that. I got on some kind of an ego trip with you. And I can blame how tired and everything else I was, but fundamentally, I am responsible for my behavior. And that was not right of me. That was wrong. I apologize. You know, one time I was in my office at home writing on the subject of patience. And as I was writing, I could hear out in the hall, right outside my office door, all this noise, this banging, this yelling, particularly banging against walls. And I could feel my patience going down. But I continued to write about it. And this noise and banging kept going on and on. What was happening was that my son David was banging on the bathroom door. And then I lost it. I mean, I went outside. Now, what are you kids doing out here? David, you have any idea how disturbing this is to me? I'm trying to write. This takes concentration. Now, David, you get into your room. I went down to the other end of the hall, and there I found Sean laying on the ground, bleeding from the mouth. They had been playing tackle football in about a 3.5-foot-wide hallway. And Sean got some kind of an elbow in good faith, and he was bleeding. David had gone down to the bathroom to get a wet towel to help his brother. And my daughter Maria was taking a shower, and she wouldn't open up. I had completely misinterpreted the whole situation, and I'd overreacted. So I went in to apologize to David. Just as I opened the door, he said, "I won't forgive you." "Why not, son? Honestly, I didn't realize you were trying to help your brother. Why won't you forgive me?" "Because you did the same thing last week." In other words, he was saying, "Dad, you're overdrawn. You're not going to try to talk yourself out of a problem you behaved yourself into again, are you?" So the constant need to apologize. So when you apologize to your own children about the same thing you've apologized to them before, tell them that. "I know I've done this before." And fully apologize, completely. "I'm struggling with all of these principles myself, and I'm going to try to do better. I really am. And kids, if I do this again, call me on it right off the bat, because sometimes I don't have the courage to act on my own convictions, and I need to be called up short on it. Would you? I need to become better. This is the first time I've ever done parenting, but I can't explain myself away. That was wrong of me. I apologize to you." Let's go into the last deposit. Learning to forgive when you've been offended. The opposite of that is to hold a grudge and to really let it congeal inside until it exacerbates, it worsens, it festers until it becomes a fundamentally deep problem. It isn't the snake that bites us that does us serious harm. It's chasing that snake that drives the poison to the heart. In the last analysis, no one can really hurt us, the true internal self. They might hurt the body, they might hurt the economic circumstance, but the true identity, the person, is only hurt in the chosen reaction to what other people do. Far greater damage is done in not forgiving than in the original offense. Now, the interesting thing about this is that if we have been offended, we should take the initiative. See, most people will not do that. If we have offended, we should take the initiative. Obviously, most people would acknowledge that. But if we have been offended, we think the initiative lies with them. But look, the harm is done by the chosen response. You may learn just to not take offense. But what if that person continues to offend? Wouldn't it be better to give feedback to help that person? So you would go to that person and build a sufficient relationship in the right, appropriate kind of environment where you could give the feedback. Otherwise, this thing can go on and fester and get worse. And consequently, relationships deteriorate. They don't take them as seriously. And the sad thing is when we do it in our own family life, realizing that people can change and grow, and just like you and I have made mistakes, and we want to have the opportunity to change and grow and to be perceived in a new light. So do other people. But the reason why we don't do that is because our security comes too much from how we're treated. Well, then people get easily offended, and then they get into prejudices and labels and cutting humor and sarcasm and cynicism. What's that? It's just the emotional, mental defenses to protect people against being open and vulnerable. Because people don't learn to forgive and to start a new day and to give people a new chance. They hold grudges. They protect and get defensive. This really undermines the development of a beautiful family culture. That is why, in addition to our own kind of apology and changing ourselves, we need to let it go, to forgive.
Before discussing each of the seven habits, let's briefly consider the overall picture of these habits. Life can be compared to a journey that's filled with challenges and obstacles. The seven habits, in a sense, are like seven steps leading over a challenging hill, and then over another hill and another. These seven habits, or seven steps, provide a pathway from dependence to independence, and finally to interdependence, where we cooperate with others. By following the seven habits, you and your family can build a beautiful family culture which will enable you to overcome life's difficult challenges. Stephen now begins teaching the principles associated with the seven habits of highly effective families. First, he discusses habit one, be proactive, and this habit's underlying principle of taking individual responsibility for our life and choices.
Let's look now at habit one, be proactive. Habit one, be proactive, basically means that your life is a product of your values, not your feelings. Your life or your family life is a product of your decisions, not your conditions. For instance, you're planning a picnic with your family. You're very excited about it. You've made all the preparations. You decided where to go, and all of a sudden, it becomes stormy. And the weather just ruined your plans. Well, proactive people carry their weather with them. They realize what their purpose really was. Then they creatively have a picnic elsewhere, even if it's in their own basement, with some special games. They simply make the best of that situation. To be proactive basically means you take the initiative and you do what's necessary to make good things happen. In other words, you're the creative force of your own life. The opposite of being proactive is to be reactive, which basically means that your life is a function of your feelings, your moods, your impulses, other people's treatment of you, in other words, the conditions of your life, such as taking out your anger on your loved ones at home because you're so frustrated. You feel victimized. You feel like you're under the control of other forces. Other people are doing it to you. The teenage children are killing the spirit of your home life. Your spouse may be even very oppressive, very inconsiderate. Your parents may have abused you on a consistent basis. And you grew up with what's called a shame-based identity. You came from a dysfunctional family. All of these things could have happened to you. And so you feel you have ample justification and reason to essentially say, I am what other people have made of me. I am what my past has made of me. I am what is happening to me. And not to take responsibility. To make good things happen. The underlying principle of habit one, be proactive, is to take responsibility.
In my family, when there's a conflict, you fight. You yell, you scream, whoever's loudest wins, and you don't talk for 3 days. And then it just gets glossed over and you go on with your lives and it's never mentioned again. And when I started dating my husband, he did something that made me really mad. And so, of course, I yelled and I screamed and was very voracious about it. And he just listened to me very carefully and nodded and said, "I'm sorry, that was really inconsiderate of me." And I didn't know what to do, because my understanding was, you do something wrong, I react violently, and then it's gone. I said, "I don't know what to do now. No one ever gave me that kind of response. You're supposed to yell back, see, and then we do this for a couple of days and it's over." And so that was a very clear picture that between the stimulus and the response, I had something to do there. I had a choice to make.
See, the concept is that you and I have the capacity to choose our response. I am responsible. I am response-able. It's so much easier to say, "I'm not responsible," than to say, "I'm irresponsible." But if a person can emotionally say, "I am today what I am because I so chose to be that," they can also say, "I choose otherwise."
We can divide events and circumstances into two categories: those we can affect or influence by our choices, either directly or indirectly, and those that we cannot affect or influence at all. Stephen illustrates how working within our circle of influence is the only way we can effectively produce desired results and truly influence and lead those at home.
Imagine, if you will, two circles. One, a larger circle we could call the circle of concern. And the second is a smaller circle inside the larger circle that we could call the circle of influence. Circle of influence basically means that these are the things you can do something about. You have influence upon them, or you control them, such as your health, your family, your work, something that you can attempt to do something about. The circle of concern, the outer circle, represents things you can do nothing about. For instance, we have no control over the weather, or other natural disasters, or all kinds of political and international forces that are at work. At least we can't do anything about them in the short run. Now, the proactive person basically focuses on which circle? Think about it. It's always the inner circle of influence. What do you think happens to it when it gets focused upon? It gets larger and larger, and the more you're able to influence. Where does the reactive person focus? On the outer circle. Things outside themselves over which they have no control or influence at all. Why? They feel victimized, see? Look at this person I have to live with. Look at these kids. They're driving me crazy. Well, why do you choose to go crazy? Well, I mean, what else could you do? Well, I don't know. Think. What other alternatives do you have other than choosing to go crazy? I don't know. Think hard. I guess maybe I could try to rebuild a relationship to a point where we could come up with some kind of agreement. What's your choice? In other words, through dialogue, you begin to identify people do have choices, and immediately it throws the issue in the inner circle of influence. What will your choice be? In fact, we have in our family kind of a joke. We saw this Tarzan film and learned the repertoire of the monkeys to where we could literally act out this repertoire. So sometimes, as a joke in our family, when we begin to see ourselves getting reactive, we'll often go into monkey behavior, which clearly communicates to us very, very rapidly, oh, there's no space between stimulus and response. We've been reduced to the animal level. I'll tell you some things that you'll know that are not in your circle of influence. I call these the emotional cancers of life. If you find yourself complaining, comparing, criticizing, or competing, any of these kinds of motivations, I'll guarantee you're probably pretty far out of your circle of influence. Complaining. Murmur, 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 and nothing's right. What a lousy day. You see, people who murmur all day long, you know that they're talking about things of which they have no control in their mind. Another very common emotional cancer is just criticizing. Where does it say in all the great literature to confess another person's sins? It's a definite withdrawal process from the emotional bank account, and in a family culture, it causes other family members to gradually pick up that same tendency. Another very common one is comparing. Why aren't you more like your brother? Look how he applies himself. Why can't you? See? You're not as pretty as. You're the more handsome one. You're better than so-and-so. All kinds of social comparisons between people. It's common language. You see, if you're making comparisons, you're already in a negative energy. We must try to avoid comparison language. Never compare one child against another, because it can affect their sense of worth from how well he or she stacks up with the rest of the family. You want their sense of worth to come from within themselves. Another very common cancer is competing. Contests and competitions have place in the marketplace or perhaps the athletic place, but not in the home place. I'm talking about the kind of competition when you're always, in a sense, studying how well you stack up and keeping score continuously, cultivating the spirit of scarcity, not abundance. Your kids take you on, you take them on back. Your spouse takes you on, you take him or her on back. Husbands and wives competing with each other around child discipline issues, financial issues, in-law issues, taking on the teenager because the teenager takes you on. Competing, who's going to win? Power contests, ego battles. See, these are metastasizing cancers. That represents this larger outer circle. The outer circle gets larger and larger. These four emotional cancers all lie in the outer circle. I'll tell you what's in the inner circle. It's the bees. Something you can be. Be more patient. Be more forgiving. Not the haves. The haves are on the outside. If only I had a more patient husband. If only I had more obedient kids.
This completes the first CD. Please insert the second CD to continue with the program. Stephen now describes how each of us can become a transition person in our own life and in our family by breaking with ineffective patterns of the past and replacing them with principles of effectiveness.
We can apply this to single individuals and families. We know individuals that have come out of deep abuse and have transcended it and stopped transferring that kind of tendency to the next generation. We have examples all around us of families and individuals that transcended their circumstances. I love the statement from George Bernard Shaw, "People are always blaming their circumstances for what they are." I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they don't find them, make them. You see, you can become a transition person in your own marriage, your own family. How many of you see tendencies in yourself you're not happy with? How many see some of those tendencies going into your kids? How many even have grandkids and you see some of them going into that generation? How many see some of those tendencies in your parents, in your grandparents? Now look, I just went through five generations. Do you know what a transition person is? It means you stop the transmission of those negative or unhealthy tendencies with you. You stop them. They don't go into your kids. They don't go into your grandkids. It means that you have the freedom to rise above negative scripting, negative tendencies that have been passed down to you from earlier generations. And if they're deep in you, you're going to have to practice more proactive muscles until you become free of these tendencies. Then they don't go into your kids. It won't affect them. Your proactive nature is built right into their natures, into their attitudes, and you have become a transition figure in your family.
I grew up in a family that was very reactive, so it was a very painful and conscious process as an adult for me to learn to be a proactive person. I think both of my sisters and I are transition people in our family, and we've kind of come through that process together of learning to be proactive.
And it's spreading. I have no children, but it's working with some of their children and nieces and nephews, and so it's happening. The whole difference in terms of feeling satisfied and leading a productive life for me is knowing that I do not have to respond in old ways to situations. I can pause mentally or actually between an event and my reaction, and I can choose an attitude or a spirit or a behavior.
You see, if you came out of an angry family, you must change that and become full of gentleness, sweetness, and kindness. Why? Because in some way, through your own personal struggle and suffering, you absorb all of the earlier generations and surmount it in order to radiate this new kindness. Perhaps you came out of this deeply dysfunctional home. You may have been abused in many ways for a long period of time, to where you never really developed a sense of your own personal worth, and you're suspicious instantly of all of those in authority. They're guilty by association with the way early authority figures have messed up your life. And there's no question about it. These psychic forces powerfully influenced you. But neither is there any question that there is a space between these woundings, these psychic forces, these traumas, these past scarrings, and your own power to choose your response. There is a space there. Gradually, by using self-awareness, as it comes into your consciousness, the space between stimulus and response gets larger. And by using imagination and conscience, you can say, I don't have to abuse my child because I was abused. How am I going to do that? How am I going to transcend this? How can I stop the transmission of this tendency from going to the next generation? That becomes your challenge.
Stephen concludes his discussion on being proactive by explaining how, by being a transition person, we can choose our own response to a given situation, creating our own moods, conditions, our own circumstances.
Let me relate to you the story of a woman who came to me to tell me the suffering and the sacrifice internally that she had to go through in order to start to develop a relationship with her children and the creation of a beautiful family culture. These are her very words. For years and years, I fought with my children, and they fought with each other. I was constantly judging and criticizing and scolding. I knew something had to be done, but I didn't know what. I did know my incessant critical nagging was hurting their self-esteem and the whole spirit of our home, causing much of this contention. Again and again, I would resolve and try to change, but just as often I would fall back. Then I'd feel awful, guilty, angry with myself. I hated myself, and as I saw my own weakness in my children's behavior, I took out my self-anger on them. Then I'd feel more guilty, and the more guilt I felt, the angrier I expressed myself. Eventually, I decided to make my problems a matter of sustained thought, meditation, and specific and earnest prayer. Gradually, I came to two insights about my real motives and reasons for my negative critical behavior. First, I came to see more clearly the impact of my own childhood home experiences. Now notice, she's using self-awareness, her memory. She began to see the psychic scarring of her own upbringing. Our home was broken in almost every way. Eventually, it ended in divorce. I can't ever remember seeing my parents talk through their problems and differences. They would argue and fight, or they'd angrily separate. The silent treatment, and sometimes it would last for days. So when I had to deal with the same issues and problems with my own family, I had no model, no example to follow. I really didn't know what to do. Instead of finding a model or fighting it through within myself, I would take out my frustration and my confusion on the kids. And yet, as much as I didn't like it, I found myself dealing with my children exactly as my parents did with us. Now notice, she is becoming a transition person through self-awareness, through self-understanding. Now notice how she also examines her own motives. One more immensely helpful self-insight came to me. I was trying to win, that is, to wrest social approval out of my own children's behavior. Again, see, she was trying to get other people to like her by the good behavior of her children. Because I was constantly fearful of being embarrassed, I constantly instructed and threatened and bribed and manipulated to get my kids to behave. Also, others would think well of me. I could then see, in my own hunger for approval, that I was shielding my own children from growth and responsibility. I was helping cause the very thing I feared, irresponsible behavior. She shared those two insights with me, and I asked her specifically, how do they help you become a transition figure in your own family? She said, they've made all of the difference in the world. I now realize I have to conquer my own problems within myself instead of taking them out on others. See, she has a vision, she has a sense of conscience, and she's willing to act. She said, my unhappy, confused childhood inclined me to be negative, but it didn't force me. I still had my agency. I could choose to respond differently. It was futile to blame my parents or my circumstances. Oh, it was hard to admit this to myself. Very hard. You see, what she's describing here is this internal suffering, this sacrifice, that's very, very real, that we go through emotionally inside ourselves to gradually align our basic motives and our basic behavior, our attitudes, with principles, with those values that will align the basic motives and the feelings, the thought processes, and the behaviors with a vision of what's possible, and with principles that will help produce what's possible. Going on with her expression, I struggled with years of accumulated pride, but as I gradually swallowed the bitter pill, I had a marvelously free feeling. I was in control. I could choose a better way. I was responsible for myself. I've now learned to retire frequently to myself and to win my own battles privately, to get my motives straight. And now when I get into a frustrating situation, I stop. I pause. I study what my tendencies are. I examine them. I compare them against the vision. Then I back away from impulsively speaking or striking out. I constantly strive for perspective and control. Sometimes I simply go alone and struggle the thing through on my own. I find new models, new examples to follow. We simply do not win our own battles on someone else's battlefield. As a great teacher once said, the greatest battles of life are fought out daily in the silent chambers of our own soul.
Stephen now discusses Habit 2, begin with the end in mind. Habit 2 is based on the principle of personal leadership. Stephen explains how we can create powerful mission statements in our personal and family lives, so that we can focus on a vision of the future which will be greater than any baggage we might have from our past.
Now, in a sense, habit one is the habit of personal vision. You gain a vision or a personal sense that you have this internal power to choose your response, and you can choose on the basis of values. But notice that assumes values. That assumes a self-chosen value system. That's what habit two is. You take leadership of your own life and of your family life. Habit 1 tells you that you can do it. Habit 2 tells you what's the direction you're going in. That's the habit of personal leadership. You lead your life. So the second habit, to begin with the end in mind, in a sense, is the test of our meaning. What is our life about? What is our identity? The whole family cannot begin with the end in mind without a common purpose, a common vision. What if family members participated to create that vision and purpose and to really participate in it and to create it over a period of time where they really own it, they feel it? This is our vision. We share it together. To begin with the end in mind is the most important decision, the most significant decision, the leadership decision, because you see, every other decision, large and small, will be influenced by that decision. So with habit two, essentially the principle is one of the intellectual or the mental creation, which means you're deciding what are the things that are truly important. That is the fundamental principle. You have a sense now of guidance in your life. You don't climb that proverbial ladder that's leaning against the wrong wall. You've done the essential family leadership work. The main message I'm going to try to get across in this habit is that vision is greater than baggage, meaning this sense of the future, this vision of what is to be created, is more powerful than the baggage of one's past, or even the accumulative baggage of the present. The power lies in the vision. As we mentioned, you could climb a goal ladder of success, and then discover on reaching the top rung that's leaning against the wrong wall. This is a vision of what the right wall is that you want to put your ladder against. Benjamin Singer did a great deal of work with the analysis of children. What enabled these children to succeed and others not to succeed? And he found the key thing was they had a future focus. They had a long-term horizon. They felt that their behavior would make a difference, and it gave them multiple options. The others, who had a sense of failure, had few options in their mind because they didn't have this sense of the future, or that if they did, their own life would not make a difference. But the successful ones literally shaped their own future. Well, what about the concept, then, of using this idea with a whole family to create a beautiful family culture and to envision, let's say, a 25th wedding anniversary or a 50th anniversary or a special time of celebration and to describe it in detail so that everyone can see who's there, what the feeling is, what the quality of the relationship is, how problems were overcome and surmounted. You see, the whole concept of building this mission statement helps to create that kind of image in people's minds. And if it is referred to again and again and again, you can see exactly how such a vision could be greater than the baggage of one's past, how the sense of the future would be more powerful than the sense of the past or even of the present. So what I'm going to recommend here, which to me is the most practical manifestation of habit two, begin with the end in mind, and very, very doable, is the development of personal and family mission statements, written mission statements. You will find this, that you can work on a personal mission statement, and eventually it will lead you to a family mission statement. Or you could go to work on a family mission statement, and it will lead you to a personal mission statement. Why? They are absolutely inseparable. So if you deal with your personal life, it will of necessity affect your family. If you work on the family mission statement, you're trying to develop a value system in that family that you will be committed to, which of necessity drives the personal mission statement.
Stephen continues his discussion of mission statements by describing the process of involving each family member in the development of his family's mission statement.
We would meet together as a family once a week, and we would discuss different things, different values, have different fun activities. But we began gradually to talk about the deeper issues and questions. What about our family? Essentially, I was asking, how do we create a beautiful family culture? What kind of a family do we want? Really, let's think about it. What kind of a home would you like to invite your friends to? What is embarrassing to you? What makes you feel comfortable here? What makes you want to come home? What makes you feel drawn to us as your parents so that you're open to our influence and us to your influence? Let's discuss this thing. Oftentimes we would talk about it at dinner or just ponder it privately and personally, but then we would again come back to these family meetings to discuss the formation of a mission statement. I don't even remember now at the time whether we were thinking so much of a personal written one, but I know that it drove it. And out of that experience, I developed my own personal one, which was really a kind of brief summary of other ones that I had put together over a period of time, till finally the personal one was reduced to 5 words, each word so pregnant with meaning and symbolism that it communicates 1,000 things to me. It's very private, so I don't share it. But I do share my family mission statement, which was the result of a very extended process over a period of time. Some of the children weren't interested in this process, I remember, or they just thought we should rush it through. They didn't see the reason for all this serious talk. The net effect was that we developed this one, which is only about 40 words long, but it has tremendous significance to us, particularly as we examine ourselves against it in our weekly family meetings to see how well we live up to it. The mission of our family is to create a nurturing place of faith, order, truth, love, happiness, and relaxation, and to provide opportunity for each individual to become responsibly independent and effectively interdependent in order to serve worthy purposes in society. Let's discuss for a moment, what are the basic criteria of a good mission statement, personal or family? First criterion I suggest is that these mission statements should be timeless. Second, they should deal with both ends and means. Third, they should deal with all four of our needs, to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. And fourth, it should deal with basically all of the roles of our lives.
Stephen next points out three cautions to keep in mind while developing personal and family mission statements.
The main problems I have found in developing personal and family mission statements lie in three areas. First, they're rushed. Second, they're announced. And third, they're forgotten. When they're rushed, that is, done efficiently and announced so that people are told what it is, obviously they will forget it. They'll go back to their own style and to their own activities and program. It's the process of deep and genuine involvement, of listening to each other, and of creating synergistically this mission statement that writes its principles, its values, its purposes into the tablets of the heart and of the mind. And it begins to impact, to use the computer language, the software of people. We received a letter from a person who said, "Our family mission statement literally saved our family." And then he went on to say of his own daughter's struggle with drugs and how she, his wife, and himself were at such desperate odds against each other around these issues that only by referring to their family mission statement and deciding that they were not going to abandon it, nor to abandon their daughter, were they able to get through those very, very difficult days.
Once family mission statements are completed, and family members begin to live by them, the positive effect on family relationships can be both immediate and rewarding, as Stephen shows in this illustration.
Let me share the experience with another. In my work, a professional said, and he worked a great deal with people to try to help people, "I often felt frustrated in my inability to really help these good people. But to add to my dismay, some of my own family members were struggling, and I couldn't even help them find adequate solutions to their problems." On the subject of writing a personal mission statement, I saw a quote from Robert Louis Stevenson's mission statement, "To make upon the whole a family happier for my presence." That's the totality of the mission statement. "To make upon the whole a family happier for my presence." I knew that my family loved me. However, I couldn't be sure that they were happy when I came home. My orientation was to find mistakes and errors and root them out of the family environment. I could always point out who had not flossed and brushed, who had not practiced their music lessons. But this simple statement above from Robert Louis Stevenson, placed in my personal mission statement and adhered to, has made all the difference. My sons will tell you that the 7 habits have given them a new dad. My family's mission statement has provided the focus point to eliminating ineffective family habits. We speak more positively. We are kinder, quieter, and more patient with each other. We are happy and have fun together. We are resilient to illness, societal problems, mistakes, and challenges. We have a process for living together. This process is nothing complicated. Any family can do it. When we forget and behave outside the principle-centered leadership process, We find we always get bitter fruit. We are slowly, optimistically, and permanently making changes that are yielding sweet fruit. You might be interested in their family mission statement. Now think about the four needs of people as I read this, because they're all contained here, explicitly and also implicitly. Remember what they are: the physical need to live, the relationship need to love, the mental need to learn, and the spiritual need to have meaning, to leave a legacy. So here's how their mission statement reads. Our family is happy and has fun together. We all feel secure and that we belong. We support each other fully in our seen and unseen potential. A family where there is unconditional love. We show respect, kindness, and consideration for each other. A family where we can continually grow in mental, physical, social, emotional, and spiritual ways. We discuss and discover all aspects of life. We nurture all life forms and protect the environment. A family that serves each other and the community. A family of cleanliness and order. We believe that diversity of race and culture is a gift. We appreciate the grace of God. We hope to leave a legacy of the strength and importance of families. I commend to you the writing of a personal and of a family mission statement that deals with all four needs, that is, to live, to love, to learn, to leave a legacy. Using what words you wish, because words are only symbols of meanings, and the meanings lie in people, and you need to create the kind of environment that allows the unleashing of these meanings into words that have significance to those people. Don't be discouraged. Take time. This is a fun process. Initially, they may wonder what's happening. Start softly, perhaps. Just discuss it privately, one-on-one sometimes, or perhaps at dinner, at breakfast, or on a vacation. When people are in kind of a reflective state of mind, start to discuss it. Then you might want to share some of the things you've learned about this, and make it a little more formal and explicit with the idea that you want to come up with a mission statement that will serve as a kind of unifying and motivating influence for everybody, one that will create this beautiful family culture that people love to come home to, that people feel warm and accepted and respected and loved and valued and appreciated, a place that they can rest in, even if it's only between a little boy and his mother. If there's only two people in that family, or if there is no other person in the family except the opportunity of that person to extend out to cousins or to brothers or sisters, aunts or uncles, or if there isn't any extended or intergenerational family to go into other people's families and other people's lives in the neighborhood or community or the church in some way, to get socially connected with people that matter a great deal to you, and to define that as your family, so that you have this warm place of acceptance and belonging where you can think out loud without fear of being ridiculed or censored or embarrassed in any way. But you can begin to see, I'm sure, that unless people pay the price at the personal level, they won't be able to do this at the family level really successfully. They could talk it. They could think it, they could even write it, but unless it is deep within them, deep sincerity, deep integrity, it will not happen. That's why this process that I'm talking about is very practical and very doable, but it is also very, very demanding, very compelling in what it requires of people. But honestly, there's nothing as powerful and as rewarding as the creation of such a vision in people's lives.
Highly effective individuals and families don't really manage time, they manage self. Instead of reacting to the urgent and being caught up in the thick of thin things, Effective people at home plan and execute according to their deepest family priorities. As Stephen explains in Habit 3, they put first things first and implement this habit, which is based on the principle of personal management.
The third habit is to put first things first. The opposite of Habit 3, to put first things first, is to put second or third things first. In a sense, you become bogged down in what's called the thick of thin things. Goethe said this, "Things which matter most must never be at the mercy of things which matter least." Now, Habit 3, put first things first, is the test of our integrity. Can we walk by those first things? You see, in a very real sense, the second habit, begin with the end in mind, decides what the first things are. And the third habit is the habit of our discipline and our commitment to live by those things. It is the habit of integrity, the habit of keeping our lives integrated. We walk our talk. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. So essentially, Habit 3, to put first things first, is the paradigm or the way of thinking which focuses upon relationships rather than schedules. Why? Because people and relationships are the first things. The traditional paradigm in the field of time management has always dealt with time, with scheduling, with control, with efficiency, of doing more things faster. The paradigm is one focused upon efficiency and control. It is called time management. You manage your time. The clock is the symbol of it. It drives us toward efficiency. The new paradigm focuses upon effectiveness, upon people, upon relationships, upon truly first things. A practical way of doing this would be to write down on a piece of paper what to you are the most important things, the first things. These are the supremely important things of your life. Now, we're speaking of things in a generic sense, such as people, relationships, family, health, integrity, service, and so forth. What are the first things? Just list 5 or 6. You may wish to pause momentarily while you do this little exercise.
The most important things to me are my family, and not just my immediate family, but my sister and my mom that doesn't live with me, my church, my children, my husband.
First things in my life would be my family, my health, education, and a good financial basis to operate from.
First things for me are my family. I'm the youngest of 9, and no matter where I'm at in the world, just to be able to know that they're there.
Family, God, career, people, those are primary. Those always take about the top.
The first things in my life are personal and spiritual development, relationships, and work.
Okay, now prioritize those things. Now, this is the toughest part of the thinking process, that is the prioritization. But what would you say would be number 1, then number 2, then 3, 4, 5, and so forth? Now, I want you to answer these 2 questions. Think of one activity that you absolutely know that if you did it superbly well and consistently, would produce marvelous results in your personal life. Now think of one activity that if you did it superbly well and consistently would produce marvelous results in your family life. In other words, think of activities that help to secure the first things you've already identified. Now that you've written down what the first things are, and you've written down what is the one activity in your personal and in your family life that you absolutely know that if you did it superbly well, it would have marvelous, marvelous results. Most of you put down in your first things your family, your loved ones. I know you did. I've done this all over the place, and that's what most people put down. You'll also find that you also wrote down about the same activities that would produce marvelous results. You'd focus upon preparation, on prevention, on values clarification, on planning, on relationship building, communication. You may have used different words, but the underlying meanings are almost always the same. Notice that all of this has to do with relationships, either with self or with your own preparation toward the future, or with relationships, the rebuilding of relationships, the renewing of relationships, or whatever. So what if you were to shift to a paradigm of deciding first of all what your whole life is about, that is, a philosophy of relationships rather than schedules? And then what if you were to organize your whole life around your relationships, that is, the roles that you have with yourself, with your family first, and so forth? I've had some friends that have said when their children were little, they felt like they had all kinds of options and freedoms to do whatever they wanted because the children were subject to them and dependent upon them. And they could just essentially have surrogate parenting in the form of sitters and other people that would take care of them. They're both very, very involved. Now, as their children are getting older, they're beginning to reap the whirlwind. And the children are getting into bad lifestyles, into drugs, and into those kinds of destructive patterns of life that they know full well what will happen at the end. Now the parents are becoming alarmed, but it's like Benjamin Franklin said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Still, if the prevention wasn't put in there, you've got to put the pound of cure in. But they both, when asked the question, if you were to do it again, what would you do? They would have said, we would have put a prioritization upon our family, upon these little children, particularly when they were little. We would have made a greater investment. I have another friend who said, I've learned that for these many years as I'm raising these children, that my interests are to become second, including social interests, development interests, professional interests, not totally, because we all have to sharpen the saw at the personal level, but that she needed, these were her words, to invest myself in my children at this critical stage. And she was talking about how committed she was to this and how it was a difficult commitment because she had so many interests and so many capabilities. Another friend of mine had a very, very difficult time with his son who was into baseball. And he wasn't that skilled at baseball himself, sufficient to become a professional, but he behaved as if that was his whole life and that that would be his whole future. So he would play baseball, he would watch baseball, he would watch it on television, he would get these cards and memorize it. I mean, he was a walking encyclopedia of baseball trivia, and he just knew it all. And the father said, you're wasting your life, you're wasting your time, you're not paying attention to school, you'll pay a price in the long run that will be horrific. You've got to get back. And so you can see the nature of the ego battle that they started to get with each other. And you can imagine the interactions and how they were both discussing with each other and would walk out and then not talk. Then gradually the father would be guilt-tripped from that and he'd go back in to try it because he cared about the boy. As soon as the father started to think deeply on the concept, what is important to another must be as important to you as the other is to you, the father began to say, I've got to make a fundamental change. And he disassembled his life, essentially, particularly in the summer. He was planning other things, research and other activities that he had planned on projects because he wasn't teaching the summer, but he just abandoned it all. Literally took his son, and they went around the country and visited every major baseball team and watched them play. And when he returned, people would ask him, did you like baseball that much? He said, no, but I loved my boy that much. This is that important to me. Now, what happened was, essentially, that the boy was so affirmed, so validated, that he didn't have to fight for his identity, his integrity, and he started to move out of that certain period of time where he was fixated. And that, essentially, is another illustration of the idea that when you accept a person, truly accept them as they are, it makes them safe to reach out and to become better. When you accept them and treat them as they are, that includes what they're capable of becoming. So you basically believe in them. See, the whole concept of education means to draw forth. The concept of training means to put in. So when you create the environment, which is an education environment of drawing forth and accept them as they are, the natural tendencies, the propensities inside people are unleashed. They're released in them and they tend to become better. Plan your schedule, your calendar around significant family things. Don't let anything else intrude upon that unless it's a genuine kind of crisis. You organize so that you make sure that you're at the, what you might call the crossroads of your kids' lives when they're making the key decisions and they have a tendency to act on short-term emotional frames of mind. And yet the decisions have enormously long-term consequences. You must be at the crossroads. And you just can't be there to give advice. You have to have a quality relationship so they're open to your advice. And that takes time. I found over the years that the most important thing I can do when I meet a person who's really at the crossroads is to affirm them, to let them know that I believe in them, that they can accomplish something significant, that they have great potential, that they're not to be compared with any other person. I've even had people say to me, "Would you tell me that again to my face?" I've never had anyone use those words. And I will say that right to their face. You are not to be compared. You are precious. You are a person of infinite worth. And you have great potentiality within you. I believe in you. And I've had them say, "Would you say it again?" I mean, some people have had so little positive input of someone that will believe in them. And it's amazing, really, how many teachers and uncles or aunts or other people can make such a difference in another person's life in such a short intervention out of one's heart, out of one's spirit. I'm amazed at that. It encourages me to keep at it. I've had many people over the years say to me, "Because you said something like that at this time in my life, I made this decision." Now, that doesn't mean that all of the psychological problems were overcome and so forth. But the decisions that people make take them on different paths. And if you can influence them to take, say, a higher path, even though they carry with them some of that baggage, and convince them that they have a vision or a potential that's inside them, you have made a really significant intervention in another person's life, and it can make all the difference. Now, I suggest that families have a regular family meeting once a week. You know why? Because most people psychologically organize their life on a weekly basis. It's once a week to have some kind of a family meeting where you can have a family council. People can counsel with each other. They can talk about any problems. They can report on stewardships. Now, I think the other thing is the one-on-one visit. So it's a family meeting and the one-on-one visit. It's the way people interact on a personal, interpersonal basis. That's what really does the deepest nurturance of the heart and of the soul. One-on-one dates, one-on-one visits, one-on-one activities just between two people. Sometimes it may be between, let's say, two parents and a child. But as soon as you bring a third person or other people, you've changed the dynamic. You'll find that if you don't have frequent one-on-ones, the dynamic in the family meetings will be altered significantly because the culture will not be there. Sometimes there's a lot of feelings that people have to express and get out. And if they try to get them out in the middle of a family meeting, they might say things that wound and offend other people. But if they can learn to handle it privately or on a one-on-one basis, then they kind of come renewed and regenerated for the family meeting. That is one of the most practical recommendations that I would give is the development of weekly family meetings, family councils, you could call them, whatever you want to call them, as well as frequent one-on-one visits. I know in our family, the one-on-one date, the one-on-one visit has been a pattern and a tradition that has been so useful and so filling of people's needs in so many ways. And whenever we've neglected it, or whenever we've neglected the family meetings, the family councils, we live with the consequences, and they're always negative. So we have to always go back to that flight plan, because we know the destination we're moving toward, which is in part the process, as well as the building of a beautiful family culture. So the constant use of these two mechanisms, family meetings and one-on-one. Now, sometimes maybe just the family dinner will suffice for the family meeting. Some people will be threatened by a family meeting. It'll be too far outside the comfort zone. So what you might do is think about a special family dinner or a family breakfast or lunch or some special time that real preparation and effort has been made and great love and attention is shown to the people. And then for a brief period of time, you might talk about more important things or reflective things, or you might acknowledge a mistake you've made and apologize to the person or to the entire family, and people start to realize I'm being fed more than just food.
Stephen next explains that to accomplish the things that matter most in our lives and families, we must plan on a weekly basis.
I suggest the smallest unit of planning is a week. In a sense, you look at your entire week and you think about each of your roles. For instance, under your family role, you indicate that your daughter really needs help. Let's say she has a class at school that is really throwing her. Maybe your son has two extremely important events coming up and you want to be there for both of them. Then you have a daughter maybe you'd like to have a special date with. You missed the last date because something came up, and you both agreed to set it up for another time. Then you have something that comes up that's pressing you to break that second date. It's a very important business meeting. What would you say? I would like to come, but I do have a prior commitment. Let's arrange it another time. You don't have to go into what that prior commitment is. To you, it's terribly important. It may be very unimportant to them, something that can easily be put off. Sometimes, however, I've explained what it is having to do with a date with my daughter, and it's had a very, very positive effect upon the other person, who often says, I wish I did things like that. Sometimes you may even make a commitment with yourself. I've got to simply get my head together. I'm just stressed out of my gourd. I've got to sharpen the saw. I've got to relax. I've got to take time to get some reflection. In other words, you're just learning to say no. You see, the key in every field of endeavor is some kind of weekly organizing, because it gives you perspective and it gives you a sense of each role and the goals to be accomplished under each role, so that you can learn to say no to the unimportant because you have this burning sense of yes to that which is truly first. You see, as soon as you've decided what your whole week is like and what those first things are, and you have organized it around roles and goals, you literally can relax. You know you're going to have your private date with your daughter, so you can relax about that. You've already scheduled when you're going to do that. It's soft scheduling, but you put it in there because it's the first thing. You know when you're going to exercise, so you don't have to worry about whether or not you're going to exercise. You've already made the decision before. You know when you're going to have a special date with your wife. For instance, I know I'm going to go with my wife on this little Honda Trail cycle. We do it almost every day of our life that I come home, because I've scheduled it. Then if something more important comes up, that's fine. You can reschedule. But the key is that you put the big rocks in first. You put your mission statement at the top. Then you put the different roles of your life so that they're balanced. Then you try to think about what important goals under each role. Now, what you're basically doing is prioritizing, but you're also getting balance in your life. You don't want to prioritize yourself up a ladder of success that's leaning against the wrong wall, that's imbalanced. And you don't want to focus only on schedules. The key focus is relationships. So all the roles involve relationships, and it's very personal.
Oftentimes when priorities are mixed up, when I don't put first things first, it's because I've allowed other people's important issues to take precedence.
Some years back, I had a job where I worked first shift 1 week, second shift the next week, third shift the week after that. Consequently, when I was home, I was either ready to go to sleep, asleep, or trying to wake up, but I was never really there. And at that point, quality time is just almost impossible.
The hugest challenge in my life is putting first things first. And so to have spent the time to do the mission statement really helps me get focused. And even though I haven't been as disciplined as I'd like about the weekly planning, I still have been more focused than I was before I created that mission statement. Now I have this mental picture of where I am going.
If you want to see excited people who say, "Oh, what a relief," it's the simply to know that you have scheduled time for all the important things of your life. Then you don't have to worry about it. You can relax. You can say no also to everything else, unless the influence of the principles that say to me, "Hey, wait a minute, you hadn't anticipated that. You hadn't planned that, and it's come up and it's really important. So that's part of your overall vision and your mission of principles, so bag the rest, relax, smile about it." All I can say is, you won't know the power of this until you really do this.
Stephen now discusses Habit 4, Think Win-Win. Habit 4 is based on the principle of mutual benefit. Stephen explains how win-win is a vital factor in family leadership and relationships.
Habit 4, think win-win, basically means that your heart and mind is focused on goodwill toward people, that you want them to win, as well as yourself. You don't want to negate yourself to put yourself down and become a martyr, step on me again, everyone else does. You think win-win. In a family setting, you would want to have the larger context around win-win. That doesn't mean all of your decisions are popular decisions. You might even make some win-lose decisions. But you don't make them and implement them in a way which violates the larger context. See, a win-lose decision would be an authoritarian decision. Kids, this is the way it is. This is the way it's going to be. Now, I don't want any more lip from you. This is it. That is win-lose. But if I begin to talk more about this, I've had it with all of your lip, and this is the way it's going to be, and I get ranking hard. Now look, I've got a spirit of win-lose in me. I'm violating the context. I'm violating this emotional bank account. But on the other hand, you might say, "I appreciate your opinions. I know what you really would prefer, and I think I understand why you prefer that. We're under time pressure right now. We need to make a decision. I know you will not like this decision. And I don't even have time to explain it. All I have time to do is announce it." And you make a win-lose decision. That's fine. You have wisdom. You have the stewardship of parents. You have a larger view. You care about them, in a sense, more than they care about themselves. And you've got to draw upon that wisdom and make unpopular decisions from time to time. Now, if you have the time to explain, let me explain the reasons, the principles, but sometimes you don't. And there may be some situations where you feel like, "I don't want to even explain because I want to build confidence in my decisions even though they're unpopular." But notice the spirit is the spirit of win-win, the spirit of mutual benefit. You're not going to violate the nature of your relationship with people, but you are going to make an unpopular decision. Make it. You're the parent. You're responsible. Sometimes children make decisions based on a very short emotional span. They're myopic. They don't see the larger view. That child out in the middle of the street, sometimes you have to use legitimate force, in a sense, in some situations where wisdom dictates it. I'm suggesting that is still win-win. Win-lose is where you violate the context, the emotional bank account, where you violate the relationship, where you violate the person. Lose win is where you give in. You capitulate. You give up. You let them have their way with you. You're stepped on. There's no respect. There's no vision. There's no standards. So you just take the course of least resistance and just kind of want to be accepted by them, and you just tell them something that they want to hear. See, that would be lose-win.
Stephen next explains how we can maintain the spirit and attitude of win-win in life, even after so-called defeats. Win-win can be part of all family experiences, even if our past life and family experiences were of a win-lose nature. Stephen explains how that can be in this illustration.
Let me give him another illustration that happened just the other day. I went to see my granddaughter play in a soccer meet, and it was very exciting, and we were cheering for her team and for her. And it was very, very close throughout the entire game. I had already talked to her about setting up different goals for the game before, and she'd heard me also express this to my sons. So she was kind of familiar with this win-win philosophy, and yet she knew she was in a win-lose game. And it was very close, and the parents were on one side and the other parents on the other side, and we started to really getting involved because it was coming down in a very close game. This was the key game between two top teams from two different cities, and they battled back and forth, and they finally ended up with a tie, which to our team and to our coach was not as bad as a loss by any means, but almost, because he was so invested, and you could feel it, his energy and the parents' energy all surrounding this victory. After the game was over, people went through the mechanical process of saying good game, good game, good game as they shake everyone's hands, but the team was demoralized. You could see them. And the coach was out there, and he was trying to assuage them a little, but they knew what his spirit was. He was so deeply disappointed. So as they walked across the field, kind of with their heads dejected, I was in the middle of all of these parents. And I said, "Great game, kids. Remember, you had 5 goals. The first goal was to try your best. The second goal was to have fun. The third goal was to work as a team. The fourth goal was to learn. And the fifth goal was to win. You accomplished 4.5 of those goals. Congratulations, kids." And their eyes brightened up. And you can't believe the number of parents that came around me and said, "Oh, I'm glad you said that. That was so good. We feel good about this situation." Well, essentially, it was a win-lose game. But look how you create the context of win-win. Now, the more they get older, I find the tougher this becomes, because the pressure of society is so deep into win-lose. Most people have been programmed toward win-lose, really. They see life as a contest. They grow up that way. They were compared against a brother or a sister, and they have a comparison-based identity. They get into school, and grades are given on a normal distribution curve, which means if you got a B+, it's because someone else got a D. Then when they come into their family life, they carry that same attitude and spirit. Win, lose. So they say, "These are my clothes. This is my home. This is my room. Don't mess around with my things," or, "I want my way. Let's go to this movie. Let's not go to this movie." The parents need to try to create a win-win context and then make as many decisions as possible on a win-win basis so that, well, let's see if we can find out what all of us would like. Let me give a couple of illustrations to help teach this. We found in our family, for instance, that it was better when we went bowling to set up a score that we're going for as a family, just so that we could have some games where they weren't trying to beat each other, but trying to reach a particular total score, so that they would cheer for each other. I also found that if I could involve one child to help train another child, that it would diminish the kind of rivalry between those children, so that both would be honored and respected and rewarded for one child's achievement, because the other child entered into that achievement. And if you ever sense there's a win-lose thing starting to develop, immediately go to that situation and try to spend time listening to seek first to understand And then to make that other person's point as well as you possibly can for the other person so they feel understood. And then you gradually can move toward the spirit of win-win and the spirit of synergy.
Win-win agreements between parents and children can be a way of eliminating misunderstandings and of fostering a sense of self-discipline in family members. Next, Stephen shows how this works by giving an example of the use of the family car.
One of the best win-win examples in our family life was when my daughter turned 16 and she had the opportunity to use the car. Now, what is a win to a daughter with the opportunity to use the car? Well, the win is that they can enjoy the use of that car. It saves them time. They can pick up their friends, gives them a lot more freedom, a lot more flexibility, a lot less dependency upon other people. Well, what is the win to the parents in the use of the car? That it be used wisely, carefully, that it be taken care of, that the laws of the land are obeyed, that safe driving habits are inculcated inside the person, and also so that there is a sense of responsibility toward other things in life because of the privilege of using the car. Now, when my daughter turned 16, she'd already gone through what's called driver's education. But during that period of time of driver's education, we went through the items I've just mentioned in what you could call parent's education. Use the car responsibly, take care of it, keep it clean, drive it safely, be a cab within reason to help us with all of our other activities, and do all your other jobs cheerfully without being reminded. So essentially that became a win-win performance agreement. She would win and we would win, but also attached to that agreement was her accountability. So in our family meetings or on one-on-one visits and interviews with the children, she would talk about how well she is doing with regard to this agreement. And we would be anxious and positive toward her. We want you to use the car. We like you to use the car. We affirm that you'd use the car responsibly, safely, wisely, and that you're helping us in many ways with carpools, picking up groceries, whatever. So remember that win-win is mutual benefit. And if people love each other and the emotional bank account is there, their happiness is found in the happinesses of others. So win-win decisions are easy to come by, particularly on non-central, non-jugular issues.
This completes the second CD. Please insert the third CD to continue with the program. Stephen's story, Green and Clean, has amused and profoundly influenced people the world over. Because of its specific applications to families and to the concept of setting up win-win or stewardship agreements, a version of that story delivered to a live audience is included here as Stephen continues his discussion of win-win.
You know my Green and Clean story. My little son agreed in a family meeting to take care of the yard. Son, your job is green and clean. It has nothing to do with watering. That's a method. Let me show you what green looks like, son. Let's go over to our neighbor's house. That's the color we're after, son. Compare that with our yard, which I've been taking care of. Clean means let's clean up half of it. Now notice that compared to that. That's green and clean, son. 2 weeks to train this little kid in green and clean. Now, son, how you do that is up to you. I'd tell her how I do it if you want. How would you do it, Dad? I'd turn on the sprinklers. But you may want to use buckets or hose or spit all day long. All we care about is what, son? Green and clean. What's green look like? Good. What's clean? Good. It's your job, son. Guess who your boss is, son? Who? You boss yourself. Guess who your helper is? Who? I am. You boss me. I do. Many times I'm away. Many times I'm very busy with other things. But if I ever have any time, you need help, you just tell me what to do and I'll do it. And guess who judges you, son? That's right, you judge yourself. How do you think you judge yourself, son? Green and clean. What's green now? What's clean now?
Good. Is that a deal, son? You think about it for a day or two. Saturday. How do you feel, son? I'll do it. Do what? Green and clean. How? That's up to me. Who's your boss? I boss myself. Who judges you? I judge myself. How do you judge yourself? Green and clean. What's green? Good. Clean? Good. Who's your helper? You are if you have time. What if I don't have time? I got to do green and clean. Is that a deal, son? Deal was made. You did nothing. Two weeks of training. Nothing all that Saturday. All that Sunday. Monday. Tuesday morning. Going to work. Hot. Summer day. Burning up. Yellowing. Neighbor's yard. Clean and clean. Manicured. Garbage strewn right down the side lawn from a Saturday night barbecue. Falling out the bottom of the sack. 3 feet from my car. I could rationalize a little away Saturday and Sunday. But Monday, this is inexcusable. I was ready to move to win-lose. Now, son, you get out there. You get over here. Or I'm telling you, the moment you do, you kill the goose. You kill effectiveness. You go for efficiency. Yeah, he'll clean that up. And what happens tomorrow when you're not there? Bite your tongue. Reaffirm your purpose. Raise boys, not grass. I'll see what it looks like tonight. Could hardly wait to get home. Driving, going around the corner, there where my yard was. Tuesday afternoon, more cluttered, more yellow than ever. My son across the street, playing ball in the park. I was burning. We'd agree that we'd walk around the yard twice a week, and he'd show me how it's going. Hi, son. How you doing? I was faking it totally. Just fine, Dad. How's it going in the yard, son? Just fine, Dad. That was his accountability. Why? I violated our agreement. I knew that. That's not what we agreed to do. I bit my tongue. After dinner, why don't we walk around and show me how it's going? Before we got to the door, you could see his lip. By the time we got out to the front yard, just open bawling. It's so hard. I mean, what was hard? He hadn't done one single thing. I'll tell you what hard is moving up the level of initiative. If you nag people enough, work is the course of least resistance. You cannot hold people responsible for results if you supervise their methods. Anything you want me to do to help, son? Would you? What was our agreement? You said you'd help if you have time. I've got time. Just a minute, Dad. Ran in the house, came out with two sacks. He handed me one. He took one. It makes me vomit. You pick that up, you know. Just pick that wet garbage, stuff it in the sack, you know. That's when he signed the win-win performance agreement. And he only asked for help a couple more times that entire summer. It was his job. It takes time to set up the agreement and to reaffirm it. The tendency is to backslide on it when you see mistakes. Keep believing in the people. Holding them accountable in the way agreed.
A win-win, or stewardship agreement, is an effective tool to clarify and manage expectations among family members. It also creates a standard against which we can measure our own success. Stephen next outlines five essential elements of a win-win or stewardship agreement.
I'll never forget that entire summer how pleased I was to see a greener, cleaner yard than it has ever been under my stewardship, and how he'd get after his brothers and sisters when they threw stuff around. You see, he owned it. Ownership. It's mine. My pride's tied to it. The effect of that kind of experience and growth and responsibility has been manifested a thousandfold over the years. But notice the five basic elements that made up the stewardship agreement. This is all part of training, of communicating, of having a vision about what the work is, and establishing the stewardship. Listen to these five elements. The first is a clear description of desired results. If possible, a visual picture of those desired results. This takes time. You've got to spend time. It took me 2 weeks. See, most of us are in such a rush. Just try to set up a deal real fast, and then nothing really happens. But you've got to spend time. You've got to be patient. You've got to get visual understanding. Then often get them to make out their own quality statements of what the results will look like. Have them see it, to spend time with it. Don't push it. Don't delegate when you're angry. In fact, don't even try to teach when you're angry. You've got to get a good relationship, a good emotional bank account. Then set up the deal when there's a good emotional sense of well-being and a good quality relationship. Second, teach people the guidelines, including the no-nos. You know what a no-no is. I didn't do this with my son, but I could have said, "Son, don't paint it. That's a no-no. It's not allowed, but see, it would give the color green." In other words, anytime you have given someone a job and you know the failure paths, identify them. If you know they'll get into trouble if they do this or that, tell them. Be open and honest about it. Don't hide it. It's a failure path. There's quicksand there. There's wild animals there. You don't have to have everyone reinvent the wheel every day to learn the hard way. The best way to learn is to learn from other people's mistakes, from their failure paths. But what don't you tell them? You don't tell them what to do. In other words, you tell them what not to do, but not what to do. You give them guidelines, including the no-nos, but you don't tell them what to do. See, it leaves every other option available and open to them. Third, now identify the resources. Call on me, son. Next, identify how accountability is to be done. Set up an accountability agreement. See, we agreed to walk around the yard twice a week and he would judge himself. Then the ball's at their toe. They are responsible. They need to take the initiative. They come and they give the accounting. Next, set it up with consequences. What's going to happen, good or bad, based upon that accountability? Now, with my son Stephen, the only consequence was intrinsic. That is, in the quality of the thing done, or the activity itself. But I wouldn't have hesitated to attach an allowance to it, which would be an extrinsic consequence. At that time in his life, he didn't need an allowance. He wasn't concerned about it. But perhaps a later time, I wouldn't have hesitated to say, "You judge yourself. The job is worth $2 a week. If you do a superb job, give yourself $3. Not as well, maybe a dollar. You judge yourself." Really, they'll be twice as tough on themselves as you would ever dare be because you trusted them.
Stephen now describes Habit 5. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. Learning how to communicate effectively and empathically is one of the master skills in family life and is the key to building win-win relationships.
All right, now let's move on to Habit 5. Habit 5, seek first to understand, then to be understood. You see, the whole key is the sequence between these two expressions. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. Most people do the very opposite. Notice your own tendencies. Do we not want to be understood before seeking to understand? That is the most common tendency in us all. In most conversations, most interactions, the desire is to be understood. Well, why? That's part of this need to be loved. Love truly makes the world go round. To feel understood is to feel loved. And people have a need to be loved. The whole key to human influence is first to be influenced. What does that mean? The key to having influence with another person is that they feel like they have had influence with you. That is, that you were open to them and to what they were saying and feeling, and consequently, influenced by them. In other words, you understand. Think about it. The key to human influence with our spouses, with our children, with our grandchildren, with anyone,
is always first to understand. Now, that is the first point I am trying to make here under Habit 5. This is enormously important because our tendencies run in such an opposite direction. You see, everybody lives in their own world. It's a subjective world. It's a world that has its own meanings in it. It has its own perceptions of what reality is. And people are walking around in these subjective worlds, and then they collide with each other. And when they have to interact with each other, they usually interact efficiently within their own world. But if they're trying to bring the worlds together to create a better world or to come up with a new agreement or a new arrangement, of necessity, both worlds come together. And unless we seek to understand the other person's world, we will not have influence with that other person, nor they with us. In parenting, you really need to understand first. The other day, a father gave an illustration of understanding with his son. He was punishing his young son for disobeying him by constantly going around the corner. And he kept punishing him. And the son kept going around the corner. And eventually, out of his son's tear-filled eyes, the son looked at his father and said, "What does corner mean, Daddy?" You see, the father didn't seek first to understand his small son's level of understanding. He wasn't tuned in to the head of his boy. He was into his own head, his own words, his own vocabulary, his own paradigm. Let me give an illustration of this whole concept of seeking first to understand. If we were to take the air out of the room that you're in right now, or out of your car, wherever you are, what would happen to your interest into this audio learning process? I mean, think about it. All of a sudden, and there's no air. What would you think? I mean, it wouldn't make any difference how interesting, how fascinating this could be. It has nothing to do with it. You want air. You want survival. And that's all you want. Now, once you get it, once you get your air, now what happens? Your interest now shifts to learning. But until you got it, you had no interest in learning. Now that is a fascinating idea. You see, it's only the unmet need which motivates. Now, in what way is this an analogy for this concept of seek first to understand, then to be understood? You know what the emotional and psychological equivalent of air is to relationships? It's to feel understood. When you understand another, you've accepted them. That doesn't mean you agree with them, but that you accept they are a person of worth, a person worth listening to. You accept that they do see the world differently. You accept that they live in their own world, and it has legitimacy. They occupy space. They're part of the human race. See, that's air. That's the most elementary aspect of emotional life. That's air. The most basic, elemental foundation of it is that you matter to me. I accept you. Why? I understand you. Why would I want to understand you if you didn't matter, if you didn't have legitimacy? If I didn't accept you, that's air. But if that air isn't there, parents have to realize that's why many times the kids are not open to these brilliant pieces of advice, to this great autobiographical wisdom put in bullet form, so logical and clear. The air is not there.
Listening is the key to understanding. Stephen next gives some vital suggestions on how we can improve our family relationships by improving our listening skills.
The problem is that most of us tend to get into a very efficient state of mind. We have our own schedule. We know the kinds of things we want to accomplish. We think it through in our mind. We're under a lot of pressure. There's all kinds of things on our platter. We've got all these balls in the air that we're trying to juggle, and it's tough, and that's the way modern life is. It's a rushing world. It's changing, it's chaotic, it's turbulent. Well, what do you do to handle that? You have to kind of figure it out and then be efficient and schedule yourself and then carry out your schedule. The problem is that when you get into an efficient state of mind, you try to be efficient in your listening as well. And you don't really take time to listen to understand, to listen empathically. See, empathic listening basically means you listen within the other's frame of reference. You listen within their world. Well, look, if I'm into efficiency, how can I want to really open up to your world? Your world's so different than my world. And I don't know what your world is going to show me. I don't know how open it is. I don't know how many dimensions, how many variables it has. I can't enter your world. I lose my efficiency altogether, and that disturbs and imbalances almost everything else in my life. I don't want to be empathic. That's too much risk. I get too involved. I've got too many things going. I must be efficient. So I learn to adopt certain techniques. I pretend to listen, but I am still basically preparing my response. Why? I'm efficient. I give the impression I'm listening. I look at you in the eye. I turn my head a little. I smile. I nod. I do other things to show I'm listening. But I'm not really. Why? I can't risk it. I'm too vulnerable. Not just emotionally vulnerable, because I'm unaware of what might happen and that I might have to change. But I'm also vulnerable in terms of my whole life. I'm not efficient any longer. I cannot accomplish as much.
I think the problem that I have with Habit 5 is probably the same problem all of us do. We are the sum of our experiences. We filter everything that comes in through that cumulative knowledge, all of those experiences that we've had, prior dealings, and we typically end up with a lot of preconceived notions about, you know, what's being said or why it's being said, but we evaluate that from our context, from our frame of reference. So in seeking to understand, consciously I know that I have to separate myself as much as possible from my frame of reference so I can get in their shoes, I can see where they're coming from. It's easy to say that theoretically. It's much more difficult to do because there are some things that you feel very strongly about, and it's very difficult sometimes to turn those things off. The only way I've found to deal with it is just to constantly remind myself the perception is reality, and these people, even if it's not my reality, it's theirs.
My mentor, really, for Habit 5 has been my husband. He is amazing at just listening and understanding, and before he even says a word or makes a suggestion, it's all about understanding where I'm coming from. And that is a skill I'm really trying to learn from him. It's very valuable.
I consider myself a really good listener, and I tend to, like, focus on what's really going on around me at work a lot because I don't want to miss anything, and I want kind of like cohesiveness in the group. But then when I get home, I want those same things, but it's like I'm just mentally drained from doing it at work a lot of times. And so I'm like, I do that type of listening where you go, you know, shake your head like, oh, yeah, yeah. I stick a video in for the kids, and my husband, we work different shifts, so it's really hard because, you know, when I'm ready to talk, then he's tired, and he comes home at midnight, so it's like to wake me up and get some conversation, and in the morning I'm rushing, so I know that's a skill I really need to work on is listening to him more.
I know for myself, if I were to fault me at the highest point, it would be on Habit 5. Of trying to be efficient with people. I've learned this. I even learned it driving here today to this audio taping session, that I was just moving efficiently, and then there was this large truck on a two-way highway that just went slow. And I just thought, how symbolic that is. You're dealing with a person, and they live out of their own world, and they want you involved in their world, and it just slows down your world, you know? And you're kind of frustrated a little, and you try to get around that person, but it's not safe, so you sit back, and then you fret, and you realize, well, that's not healthy, so you look around, try to enjoy nature. Then I started settling into myself and saying, with people, fast is slow, and slow is fast. You have to get into a whole different frame of mind, and then attach yourself to the higher values of really what's important. Is this little time thing that important? Is this little efficiency really that important? Did anyone on their deathbed ever wish they spent more time at the office? What is important? It's relationships. And with people, you can't be efficient. It takes a lot of time. It does. It's not just quality of time, it's quantity. And one cannot compensate for the other. But you don't have to be with them all the time. You don't have to work with them all the time. But you know, a lot of parents are not willing to spend that time up front with people to get deeper into the emotional life of people. Oh, if they only knew how much time they would save later on, and what a beautiful relationship they're losing by not taking the time initially. Because in some ways, it's very, very hard to catch up later. But it can still be done. And I would not become discouraged. Of all the times to make this empathic, accepting, understanding deposit is at the crossroads of life, because they are most vulnerable and they can be influenced to take the higher path and to avoid the destructive path. They can be affirmed, you can do this thing, I believe in you. I see what's inside you. You always speak to the best and the highest of what is inside a person. In a sense, this may seem contradictory to what I've been saying. Ignore their feelings. It's not what they're feeling now. It's the new feelings that are created through the affirmation, through speaking to the best and the highest that is within them. Now, I don't really mean to ignore their feelings. I'm trying to teach two concepts there. The first, to understand. Then to be understood. That means you go beyond, to affirm, to speak to the highest and best, to believe in them. Give that child an A before he starts life. And communicate you are an A person. You are an A child. And that anything that falters, that's not like you. I know who you are. You are this person.
Next, Stephen describes habit 6, synergize. This habit is based on the principle of creative cooperation and teamwork. As we live this habit and value the differences of family members, our families can be transformed into something far more than the sum total of all that family members individually contribute. Stephen next explains the near magic of Habit 6.
Synergy, a better solution where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That's what it means. Synergy means 1 plus 1 equals 3, 10, 100. The whole is greater. Why? Because the relationship between the parts is a part itself, and it has such catalytic, dynamic power, it affects how the parts interact with each other. It changes a relationship from one that transacts to one that is transformed. And that's what this beautiful family culture is. It is a transformed culture. People are changed through these processes. Why? You're now trying to put your ladder up against the right wall. The wall is called a better decision than what either party proposed initially. And your ladder is leaning against that. You've done the leadership work.
Effective families know that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. They value and benefit from differences in others. Next, Stephen shows how one family applied the principle of synergy by turning differences into a solution that each family member felt good about.
I've often told the story about a fight going on between a father and a mother about where they were going to have their vacation. The mother wanted to be with her mother, who was ailing. The father had already told the boys he was going to take them fishing. Well, you can just imagine the situation as they interacted back and forth. I want to see my mother. I don't know how long she's going to be around, and I haven't taken care of her, and my sister has been with her all the time. Yeah, but this is my vacation. I've been looking forward to it. I promised the boys, it's not anything about your mother. I love your mother. I'd like to be with her. But right now, we need to take attention with these boys. Well, my mother is terrible. Well, these boys are terribly important. Can you imagine? What are we going to do? All you have to do is deeply build habits 4, 5, and 6, and you can say to the other, honey, why don't we see if we can communicate and see if we can find a solution that is better? Because I can see how strong you feel, but I feel equally strong. And let's say she says, I can't see anything that could be synergistic about this. I mean, we're either with my mother or we're going and playing and fishing. I just, back and forth. They didn't see it, okay? Or maybe she's the one that speaks up and says, I don't know what it would be, but would you be willing to try to communicate toward a win-win synergistic goal? Then one person says, let me see if I can fully understand your point. Your mother's really ailing, your sister's been taking care of it, and this is a one opportunity to spend a full week rather than just a quick visit. Yeah, and furthermore, I wanted to get into writing a family history. I wanted to take some pictures. I mean, we don't know. This is really very important to me. And so he restates it. It's more than just visiting with her now. It's kind of recapturing your roots and your history. And furthermore, you feel like you want to do this for your sister's sake as well, but she needs a break. She's really carried the major burden of your mother. You see, this is empathic listening. Yeah, but you know, you promised those boys. And gosh, they're looking forward to this. And I can see them. They've been out there just throwing that casting line on the front lawn. And I just think they go crazy up there for a whole week around Grandma the whole time. And yet I'd like them to see her and get more acquainted with her. But and then he says, yeah, but you know how you'd feel if you were down there and you wanted to be with your mother. And we don't want to split up. I mean, this is our one chance to be together. I don't know what we could do. Hey, you know what? I heard that there was a fishing pond about 20 miles from your mother's home. It's not the kind of ideal situation that we were thinking about this other situation, but they say they catch fish like crazy. They plan it regularly. Hey, what if we were to do that? Go to your mother's house so you could be with her. Or the other one says, I don't know, maybe we could get our mother to come, but I don't know if she's up to that. I don't know if her help would handle that. See, in other words, you start getting synergistic. You come up with other ideas. But look at the spirit. That's the main point I'm trying to get across here. It's not these ideas. It's the spirit of win-win, the spirit of synergy. That's what this beautiful family culture is all about. Why is it that synergy comes out of habits 4 and 5 and the effort to find new solutions? Basically, for the same reason we talked about before, that people live in their own worlds. They're very subjectively involved in those worlds. In other words, people are different, and it's in the difference that the strength is manifested. So this is the technique you train yourself to say, whenever there is a difference, something like this. Good. You see it differently. I want to understand. You come from a whole different angle. Now, if I'm into independence and efficiency, I won't feel to say, good, I'm glad there are differences. All I want people to say is, I agree with you. You want to tell them what to think, what to feel, what to do. But then that violates the relationship, and you don't get synergy. You'll get usually compromise at best. But at worst, you probably get adversarialism and fighting and negative forms of synergy where 1 + 1 = less than 1 because so much of the energy of both parties is spent on fighting each other rather than dealing directly with the issues. So we're trying to move toward a positive form of synergy that creates new options through the interchange of differences. have an aunt and uncle that had this beautiful synergistic relationship and created a lovely family culture. And one was 4'11", very aesthetic, very artistic. The mother, the wife. The husband, the father, was a great athlete and a great businessman. And their daughter found a note that they had written to each other, which somewhat illustrates the extraordinary respect they had for each other in their differences. The mother wrote on this note, "Dearie, I hate to go without you. Please remember your pills and call me as soon as you get to the office. Glass of milk poured in her fridge. Love, G." That's Gracie. Then on the back side of the same laundry card, he wrote back to her. He called her Flossie. "Flossie, you cute little cuss. I am sitting here waiting for time for pills not to react unfavorably. Had everything to eat, read everything, enjoyed everything, but you underlined three times. This old castle is great, but it's vacant, so vacant without you in it." And then underlined, "I do love you, Pug." 2 weeks from that day, Pug had a fatal stroke and died. Imagine how precious that little card was. The differences, the diversity, became the strength of their beautiful marriage and their family life. Sometimes you might get synergy where you come up with the same solution that one proposed, but the relationship is different, which changes the nature of the solution. In other words, let's say that you're two places people want to go, and they end up going with one choice. They don't go to a third place. They don't do something else. They go with one choice. But by the communication process of understanding and how strong it is to the other person, and because I care so much about the other person, that is also where I want to go. Eventually, parents learn this, and grandparents, that your happiness is basically totally interwoven with the happiness of other people, so that you're happy only when they are. But I would say, really, that synergy is probably the highest expression of a beautiful family culture. One that is creative, one that is fun, that is filled with humor, that is filled with humanity, one that's filled with variety, one that has deep respect for every person and every person's different interests and approaches. This synergistic communication really is very, very taxing to people. And if you have peripheral issues that are secondary, you may not always want to tap into that much energy. Sandra and I have found a very fast and easy way to deal with these secondary issues. And that is, we simply say to each other, "Where are you?" That means to us both, on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is it to you? If she'll say, "It's a 9, and I'll say, "It's a 3, then we do it her way. We make no effort to go towards synergy, toward a third alternative, because we don't have that much time and that much energy to spend in that kind of communication. If I'll say it's an 8 and she'll say it's a 2, we'll do it my way. And it settles it right now. We both have agreed up front, and this did take synergy to come to this agreement, that we would always be totally honest where we were on the scale. We've also done this with our children, so that if we get in a car and we're going somewhere and we don't have time to resolve it synergistically, and people want to go different places, we just say, "How important is it to you? Where are you?" on a scale of 1 to 10. And we always try to show respect for those who feel the strongest. In other words, it's a kind of democracy that shows respect for the strength of feeling, the depth of feeling behind a person's opinion or desire. It's a very efficient way of solving issues rapidly, without having to go towards synergistic communication on everything.
Effective families are involved in constant renewal and improvement in all four dimensions of life. As Stephen explains in this final habit, Habit 7, called Sharpen the Saw.
I want you to imagine this scene. Someone comes up to someone who's cutting down a tree. It's a big, huge, thick trunk. And they're cutting down this tree, and they've been working at it for a long period of time. And they are dripping with sweat and so tired you can just see it. And one says, well, how long have you been doing this? Oh, I've been here for over 2.5 hours. And I have hardly had a break. Oh, I can't believe it. Well, why don't you sharpen the saw? Come on, I'm too busy sawing, dum-dum. So sharpening the saw basically involves renewing ourselves in the other six habits. And it deals with all of the different areas of our life, our body, our mind, and our spirit.
I am a marathon runner, and in order to run a marathon, I have to plan for it and train for it and get ready for it and do the things around good nutrition and enough sleep and scheduling the time for that. So just in this activity that for me starts out being physically sharpening the saw, a whole lot more things have grown from that. And so it can be incredibly rewarding. And if I didn't have that, if I didn't do that, I would not be good in the other things.
Part of my renewal process, part of sharpening the saw for me, is attending college. I'm currently working on another degree, and after I finish this one, I'll probably start another one. I'm a lifelong learner. It's how I invest in myself. So when I'm feeling stressed, for me, a textbook can be very relaxing. It's therapy.
These are the ways that I sharpen the saw. I start the morning by doing some kind of meditation and then read something that is inspirational for me that I hope will carry over in the day. But the things that interest me right now are inspirational, spiritual things and personal growth.
There are many ways of doing it. In the physical area, health practices, so that people are encouraged to eat healthfully and to exercise and to have fun in physical activities where they get good exercise. And also in creating a safe haven at home. That's why relaxation is one of the characteristics of our mission statement. Because we want a place where people can think out loud, where people can just be alone and do their thing and no one bugs them, bothers them. They can relax. Or a place they can just sit and have fun with other people, that they can just do what they want to do with other people. In the mental area, to cultivate the spirit of valuing education, of valuing learning, of reading, of discussing ideas, and of trying to prepare to make contributions together. In fact, over all these years, we have found that by valuing learning, we've created a situation where you don't need to use extrinsic forms of motivation. The only one that we use, and really it's almost like an afterthought, is to put the report card on the refrigerator, but not necessarily make a big deal out of it. It's just there. But there has also been a sustained effort to try to prepare for the future, a sense of trying to open doors of opportunities in order to make contributions, and the awareness that that comes fundamentally from valuing learning, valuing education, from having books all over the place, from reading them, from parents reading to children. And I saw some research data the other day that said it's very important that children see their parents reading. That kind of modeling, that kind of example, particularly when children are very little, is very, very powerful. It impresses upon them, this is what we do, we read. In fact, one time we had a difficulty with television. There was too much television viewing, and we knew this. So we had one of these family meetings on this, and I gathered some information from some professional people to show the impact that television has not just upon the minds of young people, but on family cultures. And all I did is share the information and say, you kids come up with what you think the best thing, the best solution should be on this. After about an hour and a half, I came back, and they came up with an agreed upon policy, which was 1 hour a day or 7 hours a week. So if you want to choose your 7 hours all at one time, that's it. You want to watch a big athletic performance and a movie on the weekend, that may only leave you 1 hour during the week. They could do it any way they wanted. And my daughter Maria was appointed by the family as the monitor to make sure that it would happen. And she would. She'd follow through. But little by little, we just about have eliminated television. We've eliminated almost altogether in the daytime, so that it almost is always focused on either a movie on the weekend or athletic games or something of this nature. But we got out of soap operas, we got out of watching all kinds of programs, to where it's almost a non-issue in our family, so that it is used appropriately. And we are glad for that, because in many ways, it is like an open sewage pipe right into a family, just pouring out images and feelings, and is an enormous waste of time, and a waste of people's minds, and the course of least resistance. Regarding spiritual renewal, this is a private thing based upon people's faith, their religious convictions, and so forth. But basically, I suggest that families try to decide what is it that would renew them consistent with their own particular beliefs and traditions, such as family devotionals, where people pray together, where they might read scriptures together or other inspiring literature, discuss it, and you could do it in 10 minutes. In fact, for many years, we just had one single scripture while the people were eating breakfast that we would read and then discuss its meaning. We called that a family devotional. We found that that was effective and efficient. Sometimes they would pay attention, sometimes they wouldn't. We found later on in life that they would talk about the impact that those devotionals or those family meetings would have in ways that Sandra and I never believed had any effect at all, because they didn't seem to be listening at the time or paying any attention. Family meetings where you discuss values and the higher things of life, things that are above the physical, spiritual things, and to discuss the application in their lives. These are tremendously powerful ways of renewing a family and getting rooted spiritually, but also to try to create the sense of making a difference, of adding value to life, of making a contribution, so that out of personal mission statements and out of sharing experiences in an effort to make a difference, that this becomes spiritually renewing as well. These three areas, the physical, the mental, and the spiritual, when they're combined together, provide their own kind of synergy. They overlap each other, they feed each other, and they contribute to what you might call the heart of the family, the social, the quality of the relationship. And this would involve such things as 12 hugs a day, compliments. In fact, my brother and his wife have had a beautiful practice in their family of giving compliments. Every morning, a different person receives compliments, and it has been a great emotional source of nurturance. Another extremely powerful social sharpening the saw is this concept of apologizing, of acknowledging, I was wrong, I made a mistake. You see, what that does is it, in a sense, erases the past and creates a new future. You just kind of learn to forgive and to forget and to move on. Move on in life instead of letting that poison fester and look for evidence to support it. Now, if I were to put into one word the essence of sharpening the saw that embodies all four of these needs, that word would be tradition. Establish traditions. Now why? Well, think about it. If children and if parents cultivate a tradition that is meaningful to them, then every time they go back to that tradition, it renews the emotional energy that has accumulated over the years. That's what that tradition is. Such as, how do you celebrate birthdays? Can you make that really special? My guess is most people try to do that. And that becomes a tradition, the celebration of a birthday. In fact, in our family, we often call it birth month or birth week, so that there are many events and the kids absolutely love it. And we always decorate the house based upon whose birthday it is. And it makes it special, and it becomes a tradition that has a lot of emotional meaning to people.
What about holidays? You see, if you don't do long-term planning, you could easily just give up your holidays, just because of the sheer press of all the things you have to do. But if you build a family calendar and everyone participates in developing it, you can plan holidays months ahead, even years ahead. And the anticipation of the event is as satisfying as the realization. In fact, in some ways, it's much more satisfying because you have it again and again and again. You keep talking about it. You plan on it. You look forward to it. You gather information about it. Also, vacations. And they don't have to be vacations that require the spending of a lot of money. But it can be just where you go somewhere and have a tremendous time together. My point is, birthdays, holidays, vacations are powerful ways of building traditions which sharpen the saw. Another extremely important tradition are private visits, where one parent visits with the other parent or with a child and has as the ground rule, it's your agenda. Whatever you want to do or to visit about, it's all up to you. You could have dates on those visits. You could go somewhere. You could look forward to it. You could talk about it. I know with my life, there's seldom a day I don't phone my wife 2 to 3 times because I love to feel the enthusiasm of her voice. I love to feel her positive energy. Very, very seldom in my life have I ever gone more than a few hours without tapping into my wife's spirit and energy. She is so precious in feeding my spirit. And I think she feels similarly, even though I notice she doesn't call me as much as I call her. I also found that my mother provided a lot of that. And she used to write me letters, private letters. And I remember one time on a plane reading one of them. And I felt tears going down my cheeks. And she was just telling me of her love. I hadn't realized, you know, how needful, how much that became a key thing in my life. Let me mention 2 more powerful traditions that represent Habit 7, a sharpening the saw kind of leadership in keeping and building and enlarging and deepening this beautiful family culture. The family table. Look on it like an altar. People know what you do at altars in churches. Look on the family table as an altar. It's not a place for just efficient eating only, occasionally maybe, but for that special dinner every night, or that special dinner on Sunday, or on Friday night, or Saturday, or whenever. That special time, it is an altar, where in a sense, extraordinary respect is shown to every person. As they talk about what's happening in their life. No judging, no criticizing. Maybe some humor, some laughter, some fun. But deep respect, extraordinary respect, and value is put there, showing great respect for the parents and for each child, and sit and talk and visit. And maybe for an hour, hour and a half, it is so renewing to a family. Enormously renewing. What is the other great tradition? It's these family meetings, family councils, where everyone holds that period of time special, almost sacred, and that you establish it. Maybe initially, particularly if the children are older, you establish it softly, maybe out of one of these beautiful dinners. But little by little, you set up a time where this is the time for our family meeting. What we've learned about family meetings is to create high involvement in the preparation, high participation in who does what, so that the responsibilities are shared around. A time for fun, for laughter, for activities. A time for some serious discussion around values.
and based upon your own religious convictions, a time for singing and prayers. And let different people conduct, and make them full of interest and variety. You can't just shoot from the hip and go in there and expect to have a really successful home meeting. You have to pay a price. But they are tremendously powerful in creating this sense of family, this sense of leadership in the family, and everyone is participating in developing this vision and this value system and examining themselves against it and to see how well we live it, so that the mission statement of the family becomes like a literal constitution as we have spoken about it before. This is a very important thing, that families have these kinds of dinners or meetings or both. Sometimes they can maybe perhaps be put together. If the children are really little, though, I would do both. If you've developed a pattern in your family culture where the older children would kind of rebel at the idea of a family meeting, then have special dinners and include some of the elements of a family meeting and build tradition around these dinners. Little by little, you might find that people will buy into a family meeting as long as there's also a lot of fun and a fun activity, because people are looking for things like this. They want a family that demonstrates they care about them. I know for myself, I need to get permission to miss ours. But generally speaking, 90-95% of the time, we try to get together to have this kind of family meeting, to talk about our scheduling, our planning, to talk about values, to talk about reporting on stewardships, and just having a lot of fun and laughter together. We have just discussed the 7 habits of highly effective families, how to build a beautiful family culture. I want to make some summary comments that, in a sense, put this whole thing together. If you were to ask me, what is the number one thing that would make the difference? What is the number one principle in how to build a beautiful family culture? It would be simply this. Prioritize your family. Make your family number one. You see, I believe so much in the creative energies of people, the resourcefulness, the ingenuity of people, that if it is prioritized, they'll do about anything else it takes to accomplish that priority. We must deeply, internally prioritize our family. And realize that the enemy of the best is the good. The many good things that can take its place become the enemy if the family is made secondary.
Next, Stephen tells of teaching a friend a new way of thinking and acting based on principles contained in the 7 habits, and of the effect that this new approach had on the man's relationships at home.
One time I met a dear friend of mine. He was a professor. We had offices by each other in the same building. He was very down, very dejected. We were talking about it. He said it's because his son was so disturbing and so frustrating and so rebellious, and he didn't know what to do, because he said it was truly like a cancer in his family. He said he would come in to watch the television with his son, and the boy would stand up, walk out, then come back in, turn the TV off, and walk out. That's the kind of thing that was so exasperating. And he says, I've tried my best. I really have, Stephen. I've tried to reach this son, and it's just beyond what I can do. I don't know what to do. I said to him, my friend, why don't you come to my class? Because right now, we're going through learning to listen empathically to another person before
You attempt to explain yourself. I said, we'll take you through this, and you'll discover a whole different way of relating to your boy, because my guess is he does not feel understood. He said he would. He wanted to. It was that important to him. And he came to the class, and he caught the essence of it fast. And he told me this. He went to his son within just a few days of attending the class, and he said, son, I need to listen to you. I really don't think I understand you, and I want to. And his son said, you have never understood me, ever. And he stood up and walked out. My friend said to me, Stephen, I could not believe that. I had made such an effort. He had no idea. I had involved myself in this class to learn about this. And I really cared enormously, and that's how he treated me. And he walked out. He said, I felt like tackling him at the door and saying, you idiot, do you realize what I've done and what I'm trying to do now? He said, I didn't. But he said, I just feel like, I don't know if there's any hope here. I mean, he isn't responsive at all. And I said to my friend, look, he's testing your sincerity. And what has he found out? You don't really want to understand your boy. You want your boy to cooperate. You want your boy to shape up. He should, that whippersnapper. He knows full well what he's doing to our family. He knows how upsetting it is to me, how upsetting it is to everybody else. He knows full well that he shouldn't do that kind of thing. I said, listen. Listen to the energy in you. Listen to your anger. Listen to your frustration. Listen to the judgment of this boy. Do you think you can learn some empathic technique on the surface and act with that judgment, those feelings? Well, if he'd only cooperate, I wouldn't have those feelings. If he'd only respond to what I'm trying to do. I said, you don't really want to understand your boy. Come back to the class. You've got to pay a much bigger price inside yourself. You've got to come to deeper grips of what's happening inside you until you reach the point where it makes no difference what his response is. None. You do it because it's right, not because it works. Well, our relationship was very good, and he was open to that kind of teaching. And he said, I will. I'll come back in. He came back into the class, and he took it so seriously, and went to work on it inside his life, even though it involved more than just a few days or a few weeks. It involved really a lifetime. But he realized, I have to do more than just intellectually understand it. I must do some of this. My friend caught the message. He could see that he was trying to practice the technique at the surface, but not deal with that which would produce the power to practice it consistently, regardless of its effect, regardless of the reaction of the other, so that there was utter sincerity. And he talked to me and said, I'm going to try it again. I said, he'll test your sincerity again. That's all right. I understand what you're saying here. And honestly, Stephen, he could reject every overture I make, and that would be all right. I will just keep making them. Because these are right principles, and he's worth it, and our family's worth it. He reported back. He said, I cannot describe the experience that I had with my son last night. And you could sense the tenderness of his feelings as he described this scene. He said, I sat down with my boy, and I said, I know you feel like I haven't tried to understand you, but I'm trying, and I will continue to try. And again the boy responded through rejection by saying, you have never understood me, and I don't care. And just as he was walking out of the room, I said to him, well, I'll say one thing, son. I'm sorry for the way I embarrassed you in front of your friends the other night. And the son whipped around and responded, you have no idea how much that embarrassed me. And then he teared up. And my friend said to me, "Stephen, all the training that you had given, all the encouragement that you have given, did not touch me like the fact that I saw my son tear up." He said, "Because I knew he cared. And honestly, till that moment, I didn't think he did. And I realized, here is this little, vulnerable boy who cares and who's been hurt." And he said, "I responded in kind and said, 'Oh, I'm so sorry.'" You know, and they began to interact, genuinely interact. And the father was just kind of not practicing empathy, but truly empathic as he sensed the hurt inside his son. And the boy went into other things. The father listened. And they continued to talk. And it got rich and authentic, and they shared and listened to each other. And the mother came in about 10:30 or 11 at night and said, "It's time for bed." And the son said, "Mom, we want to talk, don't we, Dad?" And the dad said, "Yes." And he said, "We continued to talk until very, very late." And then he said to me, with tears in his eyes, the next day in the hall of the building that we office together in, he said, "Stephen, last night I found my son again."
This concludes the 7 Habits of Highly Effective Families audio learning program. We hope Stephen's presentation has helped deepen your understanding and commitment to implement these habits and principles at home and in your family. To order a transcript of this audio learning program, please call 1-800-304-9788.